This episode of the Rick Emerson Show is made possible by our good friends at Squires Electric, a brand new business partner. Squires Electric is a full-service electrical contractor for all of your residential and commercial needs. You can contact them at 503-252-1609, or for more information, go to squireselectric.com.
The following is a production of the Emerson News Network.
That's enough. Thank you, ladies.
Oh. Good job.
Okay. Work with honor turns. I'm worried about her balance.
All right. How long do you think it'll be before I can do the show?
You're starting tonight.
Tonight?
You'll be fine.
How did she do?
She's no butterfly. Tony, she's all pelvic thrust. I mean, she prowls.
Change your spot.
She's got it.
I wonder how she got it.
Well, she certainly didn't learn it.
She learned it all right, but they don't teach it in any class.
After the hour of one, and this the month of December in the year of our Lord 2010. Thank you for coming along and making a part of your listening day. We are live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the milk packing district in glorious southeast Portland, Oregon, the home of all good things. Thank you for joining us today. It is the Rick Emerson radio program. It's 503-505-6964 if you would like to join us today. 503-505-6964. If you want to get on board with your comments, questions, clarifications, observations, ruminations, ponderings, musings of an ironic nature, recipes, excoriations, death threats, whatever it is you might have to bring to the table, it's 503-505-6964. You can also get a hold of us via Skype if you like. That is Rick Emerson Show. That is the username there, Rick Emerson Show. And if you want to email, you can do that as well. It is so simple, a child could do it. It is rick@rickemerson.com. rick@rickemerson.com. That's how you do that. It's rick@rickemerson.com. You can email Dawn Taylor if you like. That is Dawn@DAWN. Dawn@rickemerson.com. Dawn@rickemerson.com. She was here earlier today for Legion of News and has headed back to the hospital to be with her husband, Patrick, in her stead. Joining us now is one of our favorite people in the entire world, Mr. David Walker. Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm fantastic. It's been one of those... What is that tattoo on your left arm there?
This is a tribal tattoo of, this is, you know, when you say tribal tattoos, that sounds so pretentious, I guess.
I'm glad you made that observation. I wasn't going to come out and just say it.
It's a piece of tribal art that...
It's from an indigenous people were one with the earth.
Yes, and now they are, now they're running casinos in the Midwest.
They were spiritual people.
Yes.
That's the other thing you got to say. They understood how to exist in peace with nature, Rick, and Gaia.
Yeah.
It appears to be a series of... are those like small faces or something?
Yes, they are. And it's actually upside down. If you look at it this way, this is the right way.
So
now I'm like shaking my fist at you is how it
now
looks.
Now it's all so clear.
Now it makes sense.
Yes. Yes, it does. Excellent. So thank you for coming in on what is relatively short notice. It's been a couple of days here at the studios, and it's one of those days where for some reason the audio seems to be sticking about every 10 seconds. It's just because God decided there wasn't enough going on today. Things weren't quite chaotic enough. In any event, so today is what, Thursday? I don't even know what the hell
today,
day
today
it is.
Today is Thursday. It is December 9th. I only know this because yesterday was December 8th, and it was, of course, the anniversary of the death of John Lennon. And so, yes, that's how I know. A couple days from now, I won't know the exact date. but
it is one of those weeks where things have just been so sort of wonky for us the last couple of days, because you know Patrick Don's husband was sort of walking around saying that, and it's that thing that freaks you out because he was saying that he felt sort of listless and under the weather, you know, with the much vaunted flu-like symptoms, which is what everybody gets 3, 4, 5 times a year. You know, and so it's just that thing where the symptoms are so, they are sufficiently vague as to fill everybody with a sense of dread.
Yeah.
You know, that there might be some new plague sort of, you know, in the air. But I guess he went to work and then they sent him home because he was just like, he was like the color of a baby chick. And they just said, you can't be here. Like, you're all jaundiced up. So Don came and picked him up, took him to the hospital. And he has been there for the last couple of days. And as of last night, we were sort of unclear as to whether she was going to be here, wasn't going to be here, and she was here for Legion of News. But I know that that Cheryl contacted you, I don't know, with like a cozy 8 or 9 minutes notice, probably asking if you would be able to come in and help us out today. So much obliged.
Yeah,
my
no
friend.
Problem. You happened to catch me on one of my off days, where my schedule wasn't fully booked. So you know,
your dance card. You are like you're like myself in the sense that you have periods of probably paralysis with a thin coating of guilt where you're really not doing a whole lot. But those are really the exception. The rest of the time, you're just spinning a series of increasingly wobbly plates of various sizes and dimensions and wondering how it is that you're going to get everything done.
Exactly. And especially, and why I'm doing some of these things that are not really, you know, contributing to, say, rent or...
Rentschment. That's for the common people, David Walker. Rent isn't a concern for men. We're men of the arts. We're Renaissance folk.
Yes. I like to think of myself that way. And when I have that free time, I usually do it like... spend time reading back issues of TV Guide, lamenting both the glory days of TV and TV Guide.
Oh, Mindy Cohen, how you stole my heart. Here's the thing about Mindy Cohen from Facts of Life, and I won't get distracted right out of the gate by this. I'm just going to say that she had some really unfortunate plastic surgery a couple of years ago, and she has now what I will refer to as the, and you know immediately what I'm talking about, she has the Kenny Rogers squint.
Okay.
Like the perma squint.
Yeah.
It was where they just... like, the guy just went one loop too many with the thread, and he just said, okay, I need you to hold this tight right here, forceps, and I'm going to... and he just gave, like, the knot, like, one tug too many, and everything sort of... It's like the steel shutters on a mall Spencer's Gifts that are closed halfway, you know, at around 9 o'clock at night as they're getting ready to sort of boot everybody out.
Yeah.
That's what Mindy Cohen's eyes look like, so it's... which is unfortunate.
That is. And what's even sadder is that she felt the need to... do this for whatever purpose. Was she trying to revive her career?
Burgeoning career.
Well, yes.
For the many roles that she was being offered, they just said, ooh, if there was just something we could do about your eyes, I think you'd be all set. But otherwise, you'd be perfect for this. All right. In any event, it is 503-505-6964. You want to get on board today, you can also email it to rick@rickemerson.com. The text box at rickemerson.com is open. And you can also contact us via Skype at the Rick Emerson show. And just as we were getting ready to go on the air, I put up a thing on Twitter saying, like, hey, the show is getting ready to launch, and stand by your speakers, and in mere moments the glory will begin. And I asked you if you had a Twitter name, and you said the same thing that my friend Seamus said about Facebook, which is that you said, yes, but you don't actually, like, use it for anything. It's just sort of there. Like, it exists, but you don't actually... Did you just do it? Did you just do it to lock up the name? Or is it, like, a thing you intended to use... But then you just get like 2 days into it and you realize it just wasn't, you know, it wasn't a thing you were ever going
to
actually...
sort of a combination of the two. It just seemed like, well, everybody seems to have one, so I should have one. So when people ask, do you have a Twitter account? Yes, I do. But A, I don't feel like I'm doing enough stuff that's worthy of, you know, tweeting. I guess that's the proper term, right? You tweet it.
Yeah, yeah. See, but I don't say that. I cannot, as a grown... I am 37 years of age. And I cannot bring myself to use tweet as a verb.
Yeah.
Or as a noun, even, really. I mean, unless it regards some, you know, the sound that comes out of, you know, like a chicken or something.
Yeah,
you know, if there's a pigeon making a noise, then I guess it's not even really a tweet. But I just can't do it. So I'll say that I sent a Twitter update, or I sent a message on Twitter.
Or you posted something,
I posted something on Twitter, which I know. Here's the thing about that is I know it makes me sound like an old person. When I say I posted something on Twitter... It makes me sound like somebody who just, you know, like your grandmother who's just, you know, like using some weird mouthful of words as some circuitous machination to say what everybody else could just say in like one or two syllables. But I just can't do it. You don't feel the need to tell people you just have like an English muffin, for example?
No, exactly. And it just kind of, it cracks me up. I mean, I try to go on once or twice a week. Usually I just sort of retweet what, you know. So when I'm doing the show with Court and Bobby, Fatboy is always posting that the show's up, and I just go to his, and then I hit retweet, and then I feel like I'm done for the week.
So you can sort of have a presence without actually having to create original thought or content. It's just with one, the click of a button.
Maybe it's because I feel it's too stifling. You know, the 140 characters?
140 characters.
Yeah, that's just... I can't live my life by rules like that.
The glory of David Walker cannot be adequately conveyed in such a constrained space.
And I get on there and I don't get it. You know, you see that somebody's reposted something, but then you click on what that is, but it's not actually what they're reposted. There needs to be like sort of a Twitter for dummies, but it should only be a page long, but. I don't know.
The irony, of course, is that, I mean, the thing about Twitter is that it's supposed to simplify everything. Is supposed to be sort of stripped. Now we just like two old guys. We just ought to be on a bench somewhere throwing feed out to the pigeons and talking about hooligans and how this used to be a decent place to live until the kids came in with their zip guns.
Yeah.
But I know that Twitter is supposed to be, you know, there's supposed to be a very streamlined, very, sort of an electronically aerodynamic form of conversation. But I have thought to is that it makes you and myself and Sarah Dillon, I think, is the same, and Greg actually for his part, that we're just so confounded by things. The thing that gets me is the hashtag. Like I don't
even know what I hear that. And
but
people
like
talk about, yeah,
it's like the pound sign.
Yeah,
and then somebody will say, you know, they'll put like a word after it, and I don't know if that's just done for like for stylistic purposes, if it's like just done for aesthetic reasons, or if it actually does, if it serves some sort of actual function. If it changes like the who it goes to or where it gets sent or something.
And I guess I feel like at this point in my life, like right now, it's not essential to my success or survival. So, you know, at some point, it's interesting because I was talking to a friend who isn't on Facebook, and I said, you know, I have trouble trusting anyone who doesn't have a Facebook page.
Right.
It doesn't mean they have to update it on any degree of regularity, but if they don't have one, I feel like, what are you hiding from the world?
Right,
you know? I don't feel like everyone needs to have a Twitter account. I feel like I'm somewhere in between the people who should have one and really have no purpose.
Do you feel like, Cheryl is actually asking, as she said, would you, the two of you like a class in Twitter? I think the Senior Center is holding a holding a course later on this week. Thank you.
Thank you, Cheryl. I appreciate that. Thank you for making me feel old.
The thing about Facebook is, you know, our good friend Seamus, who's a longtime listener, he had a Facebook account which he then deactivated. He said that he was just turning it off and he wasn't even using it anymore. And I think his whole thing was he just felt like it was just sucking up. Like it was sort of, you know what it is? It's like an electronic Horcrux for you Harry Potter fans. That it was just his soul was being divided into so many different directions, and there were just so many different places that his attention was being diverted that he wasn't really able to focus anywhere. And I think he just felt like he just had to make changes. He just had to do something drastic to be able to focus a little bit.
I'm getting to that point where I feel like I need to schedule times of the day that I am going to be on Facebook. Like, you know, okay, I'll go on at like 9 in the morning. And then I'll go on again maybe at like 10 at night and only and limit it to like maybe 15 minutes of because there's people who only email me on Facebook.
Right.
It is a huge time suck. And I've become concerned these last few months about it.
Is it going to be a thing? You should make that your we're so lame. There needs to be like a third person here who can then answer these questions. Anna Griffin might actually be able to do that because she's like on Twitter and weather like way more often than I am. In just a moment, I'll kind of give everybody a heads up about what is coming on later in the show. But I will say this as well. I think on Facebook, you can do like a little blurb about yourself or like about me or something. And I just have like the URL. But you should do it like at the Playboy Club tonight. You know, it would say like Joey Bishop, you know, 10 p.m. to midnight. You should do like David Walker will be answering your emails and comments between and, you know, like 8 p.m., 10 p.m. this evening on Facebook.
There you go. Like I could set up like hours of operation.
Right.
Treat it like a really good idea.
And let people know, like, look, if you don't ask me something like right then, like it may or may not ever be responded to. It may just be flushed. I may get to it someday, But it's not going to be today, probably, if you're not contacting me during these well-defined hours of operation.
Yeah, because there's, I was just reading something, one of those sort of steps to success sort of things, and but it was talking about how you should schedule your email time, your internet time, the specific times of the day, and not go on beyond that.
Well, because it just, because if you try to answer, can I just tell you this, and I do this once every little while just so. I think it's a passive way to apologize to listeners who have emailed me, and you know, like I haven't gotten back to them yet. In my, this is like my personal email account, right? And this is just like the one that I just like for friends and family and whatever. Yeah. Just you know, this, if somebody needs something to get something to me right away, just looking at my personal email account, and this is just the unread emails. This doesn't count things that I've seen but haven't responded to or like what. There are 243 emails in there right now. In my. In my show email account, which is my Rick at Rick Emerson mm-hmm. account, and I say this, and I don't say it to discourage people from emailing me. I mean, you know, in my Rick at Rick Emerson account, there are, as of this very moment, December 9th, 2010, around 1:42 Pacific time, there are 16,944 emails sitting in there.
Wow. Okay.
Unread.
You've got me beat because yesterday I had 1,010 unread emails in my sort of business. It's the one that's connected to the Twitter and
right.
the Facebook and everything else. But that was 1,010 that had accrued since last Wednesday.
See, that's the thing. And it's like, and I say, well, I've got 16,000. You said I've got 1,000. But it doesn't matter because they're both unanswerable. Both of those numbers are untenable.
The moment you get past 10, you're doomed.
So I actually have a friend of mine, and he has resorted to, he's trying to start this online movement. And the online movement that he is pushing is I believe it is the 3-sentence rule. It's either 2 or 3.
Okay.
His whole thing is that he will not respond to any email with a reply of more than 3 sentences.
Okay.
And he actually has a signature file to that effect. And it says, and it goes, points to his website. And it says something like, you know, I'm starting the three sentence reply movement, you know, join me, won't you? And it says, like, if you have received this email and it looks like I'm being very circumspect or very, very condensed with my answers, he says, because I got a lot of stuff going on, so I don't respond to things in more than 3 sentences. If you need more than that, like, call me.
Yeah.
And if you don't know how to call me, then you're probably not close enough to me that you really, you know, need more than 3 sentences of my time. The other thing that I have toyed with doing, and I haven't just because it seems, because it feels, I don't know, because it's deceptive, not in a harmful or malicious way, but it is dishonest, and so I haven't done it. I have toyed with the idea of adding the sent from my iPhone signature to all of my emails, because then people don't expect you to send a lot more. People do sort of, they make allowances for the idea that if you're on some sort of a mobile device, you're not going to be, you're not going to be writing them a novel or anything.
And see, and I don't have a smartphone, so I avoid that. And that's part of the reason I don't have it is I don't. People who need to reach me, they know how to reach me.
Here's the. It's like my mom. We used to get an answering, these answering machine discussions when I was a kid. My mom didn't want an answering machine, and the phone would ring. And my mom's whole thing was like, if it was important, they'll call back. Which like on the one hand is so infuriating, but on the other hand is like you can't argue with it. It's a thing that is so fundamentally dumb. It's like a Zen koan where it just becomes brilliant somehow, and you kind of go, well, I. All right, then. I see that you've bested me. You know, there's really no response you can give to that. It's not like it's wrong, I guess. Yeah.
Well, and nowadays, especially with caller ID.
Nowadays.
Yeah, it's... I don't leave that many messages with people. I call them, and if it goes to the voicemail, I just hang up, and I figure they'll see that they missed a call, and it was for me. And
you know, this is the good and bad thing about having you on the show, is that there is no regulator, there's no governor on this to keep us on track or on task. I think we've been talking for 25 minutes now. I haven't even forward promoted all of the radio mechanics and formatics that have been drilled into me by program directors over the year. They all just vanish at certain times, and this is one of those times.
I'm sorry.
Swear to Christ, my final observation is going to be this, that I have actually gone to such lengths that I have recorded voicemail greetings that say, don't leave me a message. I'm not going to listen to it. I have a phone of the future. It will show me that you have called. I have missed your call. I will see the number unless you are calling from a blocked number, in which case, like, that's your problem, not mine. But I will see that you have called me. You do not need to leave me the message unless it is something that is an actual, like, literal emergency. If you are being held in a Panamanian prison and you need bail money now and this is your one phone call, then you can leave a message. Everybody else, like, I'm going to see that it says, like, Sarah called, Greg called, Cheryl called. And you know what? People leave me goddamn messages anyway. They just it's like they don't even hear it. It's like their brain filters it out, or they just disregard it somehow.
Oh, Jesus. Man. You're a man after my own heart,
God
Mr.
Damn.
Emerson.
Let's see. And we haven't even gotten Anna Griffin in here. And she's as bitter as either of us.
Oh, awesome. I can't wait. I've never met her, so that'll be...
She's fantastic.
Yeah, okay.
One of our favorite people. So coming up later on today, we got your Hick Watch. We got a Clown Watch coming up today. Darwin Watch. Anna Griffin writes a twice-weekly column for the Oregonian about life in Portland and Multnomah County. She will be in here. We'll also do her top five, which I understand from something she put on Twitter. She said that it was she was already preemptively filled with shame and embarrassment for her teenage self at this this list, at the teenage moping list. Let's see, what else will we get to? We got an installment of Pop Culture Authority we're going to try to get to, and your phone calls and so forth. We'll get to a call that has come in here in just a moment. Somebody no doubt going to upbraid us about our technological inabilities and incompetence. This says, Rick, the hashtag allows you to create a global subject matter. That sounds like some sort of, that sounds like a scientific process you would undergo at a think tank or something. He says, Twitter will recognize those as topic search results. And if a lot of people are using it, it will consolidate those into a trending topic. See, right there, it's like it's already, that's the point where
I don't know what any of this means. I am completely, the moment he said even before he got to the global trending path, it's like, what?
No, that is the line of demarcation where he has lost me.
Yeah.
Where the falcon has left the falconer. and he says, you can see what the crowd is saying about something. Now I'm pot committed. I got to finish this. He says, the difference is the recent updates to Twitter have started recognizing phrases that don't have hashtags in front of them. All right, we're done. We're done. Thank you, sir. I appreciate your effort. Let's see. Hello, sir, madam, as the case may be. You're on the Rick Emerson radio program. How can I help ye on this somewhat chaotic Thursday?
Would this be me?
Really, philosophically, only you know the answer to that, sir. Is this our friend Andy?
Yes, it is.
Hello, Andy. How are you? How are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty fantastically. I'm going to take a crack at explaining Twitter to you, but I can understand if this is just a pointless endeavor at this point.
Well, here's the thing. I don't want to quash your motivation. I like your spunk, so I'm not going to. I don't want to teach you that it's wrong to try to help others. Here's the thing. It will be futile in this case, but maybe not wrong. So
maybe if I use small words.
Thank you. Before you do that, let me just say that the Rick Emerson Radio Program is brought to you today by, among other fine business partners, Sorrell's Vintages. You can find them at 3713 Southeast Hawthorne. 3713 Southeast Hawthorne. They are directly across from the Baghdad Theater and next to Powell's Books. They are a fine store. We'll talk more about them later on today. Sorrell's Vintages, 3713 Southeast Hawthorne. All right, I'll tell you what. I will put on my thinking toque, and I will endeavor to process the information that you are conveying to us. I can't speak for David Walker, but I will make a good faith effort to understand and retain whatever it is you're going to tell us right now about Twitter, because I don't want you to feel that it's just, you know, that your time has been wasted. David's actually picking up a pen. He is clicking the pen into place. We're going to be making notes here, sir.
This is definitely worth my 32 cents
right here. Thank you. All right. All right. Have at it.
All right. So the hashtags are if you put a pound sign in front of a word and then you post that on Twitter and you click on the word, you can see other people who made hashtags of the same word.
So if I were to say I am purchasing an English muffin at the store, and then I were to put a space bar, and then hashtag or pound sign, and then I were just to put
English muffin
or Vladimir, then that would alert other people who are interested in English muffins or Vladimir.
Yes, or if you were interested in English muffins or Vladimir, you could then go see who else had done the same.
All right, now we're entering just like the weird gray mist of confusion here. Where, God, we sound like idiots. Where do I go? You know what it is? You know what I've become? I have become a person calling tech support. Oh my God. And you are the guy who is sitting there asking me if I've unplugged the computer and plugged it back in. Oh my God. All right. So where, if I put, I am at the store buying English muffins, hashtag Vladimir, where does that go? Where does it end up?
Well, see, Rick, the internet is a series of two.
Don't mock me. I swear to God, I will find you and I will yank out your teeth. Where does it show up?
It's a server that Twitter has, and then if you click on the hashtag, it takes you to that space that they've saved it, and you see the other hashtags with the same name.
No, I understand what the internet is. I know that there's a server and that there's tubes and that a thing becomes a magical stream of electrons. But I'm saying, is it like, do I have to... I don't even know what's going on now. Let's say this is like a story problem in hell. Let's say that David Walker is on one side of the country and I am here.
Yes.
I write the, hey, I'm at the store getting English muffins, hashtag Vladimir. On the other end of the country. Don't you laugh, you bastard. Now I'm not going to be able to finish my sentence. On the other end of the country, David Walker is sitting down with a cup of Bosco in the morning and he's saying to himself, by God, I want to know about all things Vladimir. What does he do and where does he look that my Twitter feed might appear to him?
Okay, you might have actually stumbled onto something I don't know.
Well, that was the... All right.
I know how to find a hashtag if I see one. I just don't... I just tweet the hashtag I'm looking for. Like, I tweet, you know, pound Vladimir and then... click on the hashtag that I just made.
This is like when you put something in the recycle bin and somebody says, like, where does that go? And you go, I don't know, actually. And it's just, you know, and it could just be going to one big landfill.
I have a theory. It's not a theory. It's just me in general. The problem with Twitter is I assume that other people care about me as much as I care about them, which is not that much.
Right.
And so, you know.
And also, I think we are all laboring under the assumption that other people know how to use it. And I think we may have found a bit of a fissure in the foundation of that belief. Now, I don't mean to impugn your knowledge, Andy. I'm just saying that it seems like it really the A to B there of getting to the point where you were unable to explain things further didn't really take all that long.
Hey,
it was like
I
a
one
it. Step process. Really? Have you been? Please tell me that you've been actually Googling results for Twitter this entire time.
Nope, I've been on Twitter, and there's a little search bar.
It really is a hashtag, say, like, ignorant radio host at the...
No, but now I'm going to have to tweet that.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
There's just a search bar, and you type in the hashtag, just pound, then whatever your tag is, and that'll come up.
All right. So now can I just set those, like, Google alerts then?
Now we're getting into the area where I don't... Look, I'm a baker.
We're going to go out on that. That's the best way to end this call. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
All right, there you go. That's Andy. It was so great. Like, he finally just pulled the ripcord. Look, I make scones.
That is I'm going to use that line at some point.
Look, I'm just a baker. Jesus. That was...
But he actually explained... I just learned more about Twitter. Thank you, Andy, if you're still listening. I just learned more about it through his brief comments than I've known this whole time.
You and me both. I just got to say that here's the thing. It was all, like, all the frustration and flummoxing, all of the various, like, side roads and, like, arterials we went through. That was all worth it to get to that, look, I'm just a baker at the end. It's like we were trying to beat missile codes out of him in a basement somewhere. I don't know anything. I only make crawlers. Okay, this is probably a good time to do something else. You are... And then our friend Keelan just says, this is giving me an aneurysm. I'm glad we could help. Thanks so much. It is the Rick Emerson radio program. I didn't take long for this to just reach levels of utter and total inanity. Hick Watch coming up later on today. Your Clown Watch, Darwin Watch. Not that we're anybody to really make fun of the faults and foibles of others at this point, I think. Anna Griffin from the Oregonian will be joining us here in a bit. She's got her top five, the top five songs to which she would brood and sulk as a teen. We do want to say once again that the show is brought to you by Sorrell's Vintages. You can find them at 3713 Southeast Hawthorne, across the street from the Baghdad Theater, right next to Powell's Books. And it really is a fantastic place as you are approaching the holiday season. If you have, as many do, if you have developed a fetish for things of the Mad Men era, things from mid-century modern, from the sort of atomic age of American design, but whether it's furnishings or, you know, small housewares or decorative items. I keep going on about this cocktail set, which I should have bought, and that really is the lesson of Sorrell's Vintages. You go in there and you see something, you got to get it then, because if you don't, some bastard will come in like 5 seconds after, like, you won't, the bell won't even have stopped ringing on the door, and a guy will come in and go, it's the perfect thing, and then you'll come back from the ATM, and it's like, you're going to be screwed. That guy will have, he will have usurped your right, he will have bested you with that. So, if you see something there, You really ought to like buy it or put it on hold or you know whatever like right then. Daniel, who was the guy that runs Sorrell's Vintages, he's a great guy. And you know the fantastic thing about this place is that if you know somebody who's into that era of design, or if you're you know like you got your first real house, like you own a house for the first time, or a nice apartment or a townhouse or something, if you would like to add a little bit of a little touch of Tim Riley to your life, perhaps this is how you can do it. You should get a you know whether it's a small item or you know a full piece of furniture, you get it right there and you go back every time. And because this stuff, it's not like reproductions. These aren't things that they're having. You know these aren't duplicates or replicas. They go all around the Northwest, and they go to other stores and estate sales, and they pick and choose the very finest things. So it's not just like a shop crammed full of junk. I mean, it's a bunch of stuff that is beautiful. It's already been restored, polished, cleaned. You go back every time, there's going to be new items, but because it all comes from the same era of American design, it's all going to work together. Please tell me you heard it here on the Rick Emerson radio program, and leave out the whole 14-minute part where we, masters of the new electronic age, couldn't quite figure out how to use the pound sign correctly. I would appreciate that if you eschew that part in your retelling. You know, you go to the other side of the store as well, where they've got a whole lot of things that we sort of call stocking stuffers, but it's just smaller items, and they're new items as well, including some really, really great pieces based on comic art. And I swear to God, they've got this this green and black couch on the new side. Sort of a smaller thing. It's a modern couch. It's not vintage. It's just one of the greatest pieces of furniture I've seen in forever. So if you really feel like you have to buy that, go ahead. I'm just saying Rick Emerson has his eye on that. 3713 Southeast Hawthorne. Let's all exhale. We'll go to the news desk. We'll do a little bit of informing of you, the populace, and then we'll take a break here and be able to come back with Anna Griffin. This, ladies and gentle folk, is the news.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
In for Mrs. Don Taylor, who is with Mr. Taylor today, is David Walker.
All right. Well, Wesley Snipes is off to prison. How much would you pay for a $10 bill? And tips for avoiding airline fees at the holiday season. Actor Wesley Snipes, who we best know from the classic Blade films, but also New Jack City and To Wong Fu with Love, is on his way to jail today. He was convicted in February of 2008 for three misdemeanor counts, of willfully failing to file federal tax returns for 1999, 2000, and 2001. He was sentenced to the maximum of 3 years in prison. Snipes told Larry King he doesn't feel like he was treated fairly in the case, especially since a juror admitted some of the other jurors at the trial had their minds made up that he was guilty from the very beginning.
They didn't like the cut of his jib.
Exactly.
He said, I don't like that passenger 57 sitting over there. Hold on. This is, all right. This is Wesley Snipes.
It's presented as though I'm worthy of this kind of punishment. It's been presented as though he's getting his just due. Larry, I've been a law-abiding citizen ever since I grew up in the Bronx, New York.
Okay, first, does it sound like there's an oxygen tank being used in the background to siphon life-giving air into Larry's lungs? I mean, as Wesley Snipes is speaking, see if you tell me if you hear a sort of a thing going on in the air.
It's been presented as though I'm worthy of this kind of punishment. It's been presented as though he's getting his just due. Larry, I've been a law-abiding citizen ever since I grew up in the Bronx, New York.
Maybe I'm just hallucinating that. Maybe I just imagine that Larry King is always strapped to a lot of machinery to keep him alive.
He looks that way, doesn't he? He's looking more and more like Montgomery Burns.
He looks like a creature shop invention. You know, like Frank Oz is lurking underneath the desk, just sort of manipulating his digits as he says, "Coming up next week, Steve Lawrence. It'll be great. Let's all go to Elaine's." So is this the thing where he didn't falsify his tax returns? I think he just didn't, like, they just said, "Did you earn anything?" And he went, no, I didn't.
My understanding is that it's pretty much that classic case. There's those people that run around and say, "You don't have to pay taxes."
Right.
My understanding is that that's basically what happened.
So is it some guy, like, you got it? It wasn't like some, like, one of those Dale Gribble guys, though, that, like, is, like, living in a trailer in Idaho and just said, the federal government has no, was it like a protest or a thing that he thought it was?
No, he was there was a great article several years ago about all of this, and he sort of apparently fell into into this crowd of people who were
that the government doesn't have the authority
to take our. But there's some pretty wild stories about Wesley Snipes. He was involved with like the Freeman movement.
Yes,
he was like involved in the para-black military equivalent to the Freeman movement. I think that somewhere along the line, someone got a wild hair up their butt and thought, "We need to make an example of someone famous,
right?
Who and you know, he just sort of got in the way.
I mean, I guess here's my take on this is there's one of two ways you can look at this. If it is legitimately if it's a principled stand that he is taking, if he, however insane or not this idea may be, because it's like those guys that like the Northwest is full of these folks too. It's like and they're always like and they're always lurking like on the Spokane Coeur d'Alene border for some reason. But they'll get dragged into court for like not paying, you know, like their child support or something. And then they will get up and they will read some. It's like the guys who give the name rank serial number. But they'll stand up in court and they will give some prepared statement to the effect that they do not recognize the authority of the court because it has a gold fringe around the flag. And so therefore it's a maritime court, not an actual like, you know, whatever you call it, like a landlocked or continental court or whatever. So if it's a principled stand where he honestly thinks that, you know, this is illegal and it's the government does not have the authority to collect taxes, I guess, you know, then that's, you know, that's all right. But because otherwise you figure like if Wesley Snipes, you got a good life going.
Yeah.
You know, things have worked out pretty well for you. That's where you're paying protection to the government, basically. That's where, when the guy comes by and he goes, nice house square store you have here. Be a shame if something were to happen to it. And you just pay a little money and it sucks. But that is for the assurance that your store will probably not burn down. If you're Wesley Snipes, I feel like you pay taxes so the man will let you just continue to have your life where you're a star and like get the F supermodels all the time.
Yeah, yeah. Somewhere along the line, there's a much bigger story here, and I've been saying this for a long time, because I'm sure that there are people. I mean, at the end of the day, there's people who aren't paying their fair share of taxes. I mean, that's what's going on before Congress. There's you know, the fight
right.
over tax cuts. Wesley Snipes is far from the most flagrant of tax evaders out there. So there's a much bigger story, and it seems like 5 years from now, the opening night documentary at Sundance Film Festival will be about Wesley Snipes and
versus America.
Yeah, there's and not to go off topic, but there's
no, we don't want to go off topic.
But there's this year, there's a one of the documentary films that's going to be shown at Sundance next month is about the woman who got burned by the coffee at McDonald's.
Really?
There's a documentary about her because it's apparently the story that played out in the media. This woman has she was an elderly woman has spent had to spend the rest of her life in a wheelchair. The burns were so severe.
She had to get grafts, I heard.
Yeah, she had fourth-degree burns. And so this documentary is about what happened to her, the real story, and how that led to new corporate laws
right.
about how you can sue a corporation. And so, again, I find it endlessly fascinating because I've never met Wesley Snipes personally, but I know people who do know him and say that, yeah, this was more an example, someone's trying to make an example of him. He I don't think he's like Al Capone or anything, but clearly he was doing something else wrong other
right.
than not paying,
Well, that's it makes you wonder if like it's one of those things where they just there was something else that they suspected. And I'm not saying there was.
Yeah.
But sometimes where it's like, there's something they suspect but can't quite prove. But they figure, hey, but look at this. Look what file is empty. And it's just the one marked like taxes you have to pay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although what was the deal with Willie Nelson? I think with Willie Nelson, they just said like, well, give it back. And then he just like held a concert and then it was like taken care of.
Yeah. 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 He's back in jail right now, too, isn't he? For like
awesome. Did you read that thing that Snoop wrote about him?
Yeah.
This is fantastic. It really – that is one of those things where I swear to God, it really honestly makes me proud to be not just an American but a human. Reading just this expletive-laced rant from Snoop, the Snoop Dogg about Willie Nelson. And I just – because they – here's the thing about Snoop Dogg and Willie Nelson. Not unlike Larry King, they both sort of seem like Muppets made flesh. There was some sort of a weird like Geppetto Pinocchio thing that went on with them, where they both suddenly just magically came to life with a twinkling of fairy dust, and now they're walking among us as people. Because Willie Nelson just doesn't seem. He just seems like a guy who couldn't possibly exist like in the real world. Ditto Snoop Dogg.
Yeah.
So I like to think that there's some collaboration from the two of them. It's like that there's some guy in a room right now like putting together that deal.
Exactly. Exactly.
All right. Do we have another cut from Mr. Snipes here?
Yes. Larry King asked Mr. Snipes how he felt about the possibility of heading into jail.
I think any man would be nervous if his liberty is at stake. Given the length of time that they're suggesting that I'd be away from my family, away from my profession.
And so do we know, you may have already said this, what the term they're talking about?
He's sentenced to spend 3 years.
Jesus.
And so you know, I think realistically he could probably be up for parole in like probably 8 to 9 months, I'm sure. But
you know, but that's the thing where it's like people will talk about, and not like I'm not like a hardened con or anything. Yeah. But I, you know, and I've told this story before that I was, you know, and it really was almost nothing, and it was very little time. But I mean, I got arrested and I spent you know like a day in jail, and yeah. And I think Dawn actually has as well. And I have to tell you this, and I in no way am trying to say that that is equivalent to somebody who serves like actual time like in a prison. I mean, I can't, but that's the thing is like that was just so horrifying and traumatizing and just so deeply like unsettling in like your core as a human.
Yeah.
Just sitting in jail for a day. You know, and again, it's not like anything happened to me as such, but I'm in like, you know, a big holding cell or whatever with these other guys and a woman, by the way. And when they, so it was just like, it was a thing where I just had an outstanding, I had a bench warrant.
Okay.
Because there was a speeding ticket that I had been paying down in increments, forgot to pay off the last $10. And after a while they say, well, we're going to issue a bench warrant, which means you just sit there passively. They don't come find you. They won't come looking for you with a bench warrant. Like, they're not going to kick in the door.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's like if they ever find you for anything else, they go, ooh, and we've also got this waiting for you. And they pulled me over for, like, an illegal lane change.
Mm-hmm.
They go back and they run the SCMADs on me in the cop car. And the guy comes back and he says those fateful words. Would you step out of the car, please, sir? And it's like that's where you just – and you do that. And then I actually said out loud, I said – is there a problem, officers? And, you know, and then it's like hands on the car. And I'm just, and you're thinking to yourself, like, no, I.
Yeah. Do they have me confused with somebody else?
No, yeah. That's it. And then you find yourself, and then there's nothing you can say that does not sound like you are auditioning for a role in some really trite episode of Matlock.
Yeah.
There must be some mistake, officers. Are you confusing me with somebody? And just like, and they just stick me in the back of the car. They take me in. They chain me to a metal bench, like a handcuff me to a metal bench next to a woman who had blood all over her because she had just stabbed her husband with a pair of scissors. And then I went into a holding tank. I don't know if it was like gender separated or whatever, but it was just me and a bunch of guys. And I was only there for like, I mean, it was the day basically. I was there for like 10, 12 hours. And then the girl I was dating at the time came and bailed me out. And that's an awkward phone call. We're like, you know, she's like, you can meet me for lunch. And I'm like, baby, Rick's in jail. He, would you still have that money underneath the, in that coffee can out back? But that was such a deeply terrifying experience of just sitting there in a jail cell and just thinking to myself, like, my God, like I have been put in a cell for criminals. I'm a criminal. I'm here. We're all in this together. And it's like suddenly you're just playing out like, you know, like the Count of Monte Cristo.
Yep.
In your head. So this is just a long way of saying that when people say, well, you know, somebody's only going to get 6 months or only going to get 8 months or 10 months. That's
a long time.
That is spoken by somebody who has never had any sort of interaction with the criminal justice system to any degree. Because just given my like thimbleful of experience, that's a bad thing. You don't want that.
Yeah.
Jesus. So file your taxes, kids. That's the and then have somebody else check them for you. Check the math.
And if you aren't filing your taxes, don't be in movies like Blade Trinity, which is probably more of a crime than, you know.
Was that really they decided to punish him for that? That's really where they decided the one night stand was an unacceptably hackneyed piece of filmmaking.
You were going to go down to video movies, and we're like, he's got to go to jail, man.
You know, but of course, to me, it's like when he speaks, I just hear Simon Phoenix, Jeffrey Dahmer. I love that guy. Let's do one more here, and we'll take a little break. Here's Mr. David Walker at the news desk.
Okay, so let me ask you this: how much would you pay for a $10 bill?
Is the answer something other than $10?
Would you pay $50,000 for a $10 bill?
Why, I don't know. I suppose it depends on the circumstances and the context. David Walker, what are they?
Well, that's what Jess Lipka is asking on eBay for what he says is a rare banknote printed in 1902 for a bank in Mesa County, Colorado.
Oh, I'm sorry. Do we have a cut here?
Yeah, do you
have
a cut there?
What is the name of this cut?
It's Banknote.
Banknote 1.
Yeah.
This particular bank, collectors know of 5 notes, but only 2 of them are the Red Seal variety, and the other one is much, much lower grade than this.
Is this the guy himself?
Yeah,
Is he a collector or did he just stumble onto it, do we think?
I don't know, but Zebulon Miracle of the Museum of Western Colorado says it appears to be a banknote that was printed over 100 years ago. So here, I guess we have a quote from someone who's authenticating that this is real.
I'm sorry, what is his name? Please dispel.
It's Zebulon. So it's
Zebulon?
Zebulon or Zebulon? Zebulon.
You become the Oncola man.
And his last name is Miracle, though. I mean, come on.
That's Zebulon, like, Miracle.
Zebulon.
Of the planet Omicron Persei 8. That's genius. Is it really? Is this like where he goes and he kidnaps Alex Rogan from the trailer park?
I guess. I don't
know. Wow. The name is Zebulon, my boy. You're a natural starfighter. All right. I'm sorry. Ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, I give you... I almost don't want to play it now. There's no way it can live up,
it can live up to this, yeah.
I give you... He's just going to be some Schmendrick. Zebulon Miracle.
That build that's on eBay right now.
No, I'm already disappointed, but that's okay.
With that build that's on eBay right now, we're able to go through and see that there was a Mesa County National Bank. We were able to see that currency was issued at the time. So odds are good that it's authentic. It is plausible.
Are you of the Alpha Centauri miracles?
Yeah.
Zebulon Miracle. That can't possibly be his real name. And if it is, I'm going to find his parents and shake their hands heartily and with gusto.
I'm sure that his parents are both very hairy. And smell of patchouli.
I mean, doesn't it seem like you just have to pick a different career other than just being like a banknote appraiser? I mean, even if there's money in that.
Yeah, or why wouldn't you just go by Zeb?
Yeah.
You know?
Or just be doing like some sort of a synchronized ice skating routine, like right now. You know, skating for the American side, Zebulon Miracle. And then he comes out and he's wearing something spangly and awesome. Wow. All right. It is the Rick Emerson radio program. Unbelievably, we have been speaking for almost an hour with, I think, little or no caloric content in that conversation. Still to come, we have Ms. Anna Griffin from the Oregonian. She's going to join us on the other side, and we'll have her count down her top five later on the day. We will have the top five songs to which she brooded as a teenage girl. Let's see, what else we have coming up? We got a Darwin Watch, Hick Watch on the way, and more. It is the Rick Emerson radio program at 503-505-6964. Stay right there.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
With the
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's 503-505-6964. In just a moment, we will be joined by Ms. Anna Griffin from the Oregonian. We'll also count down her top five teenage moping songs, a thing which will in no way horrify or embarrass her. She will not at any time during that countdown feel awkward or desire with an almost feverish intensity that the ground open up and swallow her, sparing the anguish of a trudge through the emotional wreckage of yesteryear. I'm just saying. I mean, I could be way off. I just, it's just speculation on my part. The Rick Emerson Show brought to you today and every day by a series of fine business partners, including but not limited to Castalia Language Center. You can find out more about them by going to PortlandSpanish.com. That is PortlandSpanish.com. Ms. Clara Grebel, who is the owner and operator of Castalia Language Center, is a native Spanish speaker from Argentina. So as you were heading toward the holiday season, if you're going to be doing some traveling next year, if you're going to be heading out of the country, you're going to be moving, maybe, you know, or just you want to keep your brain in fighting shape, as they say, because there's very few things that will keep your brain, because I had this whole thing happen yesterday where it's like, I apparently have had several conversations with Greg and Sarah about guesting on their show on Friday, conversations which just slipped out of my brain like an egg off a Teflon pan. I have no, and I made them swear at one point that they were not fabricating it just to screw with me. I have no recollection of these two in-depth conversations. Conversations, by the way, which were so detailed that I checked my iPhone and I'd made notes in the conversation and actually had, like, put a little, like, reminder to myself, 4 o'clock Friday, must be on Fun Employment Radio. I remember none of this. And it's not like a sort of vague, like you kind of remember, but the details are fuzzy or just the specificity eludes you. I have no recollection of these conversations happening in any way, shape, or form. So this is really, Rick Emerson is no role model. You don't model yourself after me and my failed approach to keeping my brain functioning properly. What you ought to be doing is learning a second language. Maybe you know a second language, a third language, or brushing up on Spanish. If maybe you learned it in high school, you didn't retain it to the degree you know that was optimum. And you want to brush up on your bilingualism. You can do that by going to PortlandSpanish.com. Castalia Language Center, they offer Spanish language classes for adults, which means you're going to be learning the same way, the same rate as the other people in the class, and it's, you know, no more than 8 students to a class. You're going to get the near individualized attention. You can find out more by going to PortlandSpanish.com. That is PortlandSpanish.com. PortlandSpanish.com is the website for Castalia Language Center, a proud sponsor of the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Tell me you heard it here, won't you?
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us on this Thursday, December 9th, 2010. In just one moment, we will be joined by Anna Griffin from the Oregonian. David Walker is here filling in for Dawn Taylor, who is presumably back at the hospital with her husband, Patrick. We are sending out the good vibe to him. And apparently, well, I hope he's not listening. I'll say this. She was going to pick up a fistful of items for his amusement. I can't remember how much of this we said in the air and how much we did, but she was stopping by a local pop culture emporium. Because I guess he's got, on the anime front, I think he's got that all buttoned up. Apparently he doesn't go anywhere without that thing. It's like, it's some sort of an electronic whoopee that I think, I get the feeling he just has like a false heel in his boot and it's filled with just either the Japanese animation, you know, that like he can break it like in case of an extended hospital stay, so he's not going to be caught without his, you know, without his like Space Cruiser Yamato reruns or something. So, David Walker, what else are we tracking in the world of news today?
Well, in a moment, I want to go into a Hick Watch, but first, with the holidays coming up, some travel tips to avoid airline fees this holiday season. The experts say that there may be ways to avoid some airline fees this holiday travel season, which we know they've been mounting all sorts of. For instance, if you have hair, they will charge you more money. So Travelocity's Genevieve Shaw Brown gives us this advice for securing free premium seats like those ones that are in the bulkhead or the exit rows.
Get to the airport early, at least 3 hours before your flight, and ask nicely. It's generally up to the gate personnel whether or not they're going to release those seats to someone who hasn't paid for it.
By the way, let me just say that if you listen to the tone of voice this woman uses and just the timbre of her delivery, this is exactly the tone of voice you hear from everybody who is instructing you to ask for something nicely. It is always someone whose voice, in and of itself, it is just like having a drill put into the back of your head.
Get to the airport early.
Doesn't it sound like your name ought to be Cricket? Yeah, and just sort of telling it to, like, chin up, buck up, little camper, it'll be fine. Is it where she's now? Is she giving tips on how you can get a seat in the exit row? It seems like you don't want that. Isn't that the seat that doesn't recline?
I prefer the seat in the exit row because you have a little bit more leg room.
It's not so you can survive while mocking the fiery deaths of your passenger.
That too. But yes. I just like them because you get a little bit more leg room and inevitably the person who is sitting in front of you may lean their seat back. A lot of times those seats don't go back, but they're never going to hit your knees.
Now, if I can ask this, do you have a preferred airline? What do you typically fly?
Delta and Alaska seem to be the two that I fly the most, but the last two flights I think I've been on this year were US Air, I believe.
How did that work out for you? Because this is two legs. I'm already going to Utah this weekend, and so that can't be changed. But it's like, but it's that thing where you're always looking for, like, somewhere out there you think there's the one magical airline. Where it's like everything is spacious and comfortable and you aren't put next to some flatulent jackass for the entire flight. And it is some sort of mythical airline out there somewhere that's going to treat me the way that I feel that I need to be treated.
That does not exist.
All right. Thanks so much. Yes. I appreciate that. Before we continue the story, let's welcome now to the Rick Emerson radio program. She writes a twice weekly column for The Oregonian about life in this part of these United States, Portland and Multnomah County. This is Anna Griffin, one of our favorite people. Hello there.
Hello. That would be Xanax Air you're looking for.
I fly Ativan Air, which I think is a sister company. Does somebody in this room load up on the Xanax before the wheels?
I did that for a while, and then I was told to stop because it gives me the giggles. And my spouse got a little freaked out flying with me, and I would just chuckle the entire time.
Well, that's, I was going to say, it sounds like it works out fine for you, but maybe not for those around you.
We're dying. It's hilarious.
Yeah, maybe if you just split a little bit,
it's all for me.
Like, okay, sorry. I won't even look at your Xanax. Sorry, I'm right over here. I was going to say where they give you like a 1 point and you break it and you each have a half, theoretically. But then, of course, but then you're both going to be giggling.
That's right.
And then it's the thing where I'm going to see you on the news and they're going to be giving you the wanding, like in a back room or something somewhere. So I take the ad of it. I have no real fear of flying as such. The only moment that I'm afraid of flying is the moment right as the wheels are leaving the ground, because that's when the engines are doing that weird, like, metallic eagle scream. And it's as the plane banks upward. It's like, you know, the nose of the plane comes off the ground, and it's like you can feel the wheels leaving the ground. And in my mind's eye, I always picture the tail of the airplane not quite clearing and hitting the ground like a rusty dragging tailpipe. And I'm sorry if anybody's on their way to the airport. Look, if I'm going to be afraid, we're all going to be afraid.
I don't think that actually happens. I mean, there are a lot of things to be afraid of on an airplane, but have you heard of that happening?
Well, but that's the thing. It's like, that means we're due. You know, it hasn't happened yet, but you can make an argument that the law of averages is not, you know, statistically speaking.
You're just going to hear that scraping.
Well, that doesn't seem like it ought to work. I mean, the whole flying thing, I buy scientifically that it's, you know, fine. It's not.
But
like,
it makes no sense.
It doesn't make sense. I have to trust that they know what they're doing. But I also know that it's. Look, I can't get my freaking computer to run, you know, for more than an hour or two without having to, like, force quit something or, like, having to, you know, like, Windows doesn't run for more than a day without having to, like, unplug it and start it. And this thing is, like, it's flying.
It's defying the laws of gravity.
It's defying the laws of gravity. So, anyway.
I am the worst flyer, one of the worst flyers in the world. And I'll pop 2, 3, 4 Valium before I get on a plane. And
for
it does
you.
Nothing for me.
Really? It doesn't even take the edge off?
I can't sleep. I can't. I finally, you know what I did, though? I suggested this to somebody else. I actually went online and did a lot of research because taking off and landing doesn't faze me. It's when you're 30,000 feet in the air and you hit the turbulence, and that just that terrifies the hell out of me. And so I actually did a bunch of research on how turbulence works, what causes it, what the effects are. And there has not been a plane has not dropped out of the sky because of turbulence since like 1962 or something like that. Like, but I've been on the planes where you thought that was going to happen.
And see, there are people who would find that fact reassuring. But but I'm sort of in the Rick Emerson school. It's going to happen eventually.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's like, you know, Tokyo hasn't had an earthquake that's killed tens of thousands of people, you know, in about 200 years. However, they are on a 100-year cycle for those earthquakes. So I'm just saying. No, that's so you and I basically – so we do like a tag team sort of a thing. Whereas my fear is dissipating, yours is, you know, is ramping up.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The I take the Ativan basically just because my thing about the plane is I get you may find this a little hard to believe, but I have a lot of excess energy, and so I will shift back and forth in my seat and getting really, like, bored and
you're
frustrated and irritated.
You're the guy nobody wants to sit next to.
No, because I'm just sitting there just, like, wanting it, like, no matter what the risk, I would take a sort of, like, atomic transport if they offered it to me right now. Like, even if they said there was, like, a 1 in 3 chance that, my, you know, that I'm going to get all Cronenberged on the other side of it. It doesn't matter. Like, I hate the length. Flying to England, it's like I wanted to pull my eyes out. And so that's where I take the Ativan.
And time stops.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And you look down and it's been 10 minutes.
I watched an entire movie, but only 10 minutes have passed. How is that possible?
God damn. And let me just tell you this here. Just a little FYI. There's a little, like, traveling tip from me to whoever it is that is in charge of these things at the airline. If somebody is flying from, let's say, I don't know, Portland to, let's pick a city, London. If he's going from Portland to London and then flying from London back to Portland, like, you've got to figure X number of the people making that round trip. In other words, it's the same people. Like, of the tickets sold from Portland to London, then London back to Portland, probably 60% of those people, they were on vacation, they were traveling, visiting a loved one, so they're going to be taken. Have something other than Rise of the Silver Surfer as the only movie. I swear to God, and I was actively avoiding it. I had my headphones in, a book in front of me, trying to block all of my senses. And yet I still somehow came out of the plane like through osmosis, knowing way more about that movie than anybody ought to. Every time I look up, it's like there's the big bubbly body of Michael Chiklis sort of looming off. It was just all very – that and Georgia Rule. That was the only other thing that was on. So unpleasant. I'm sorry. We're like halfway through this news story. There was the charming woman had another.
Actually, there was, yeah. Brown, this is Travelocity's Genevieve Shaw Brown, says, you may be able to avoid some fees by looking up the policies on your credit cards.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's,
If you're carrying an airline-branded credit card, check to see if one of the perks may be to check bags for free. American Express has a Blue Sky Preferred card that allows you $100 annually to cover the cost of airline fees, like check bags.
I get the best idea ever. Oh, I'm sorry. Are we not done?
No, I was going to say, the problem with her suggestion is all of this makes life too complicated.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, in the good old days, you showed up at the airport.
Hold on, let me just appropriately. Go ahead.
The good old days, you showed up at the airport and you had a bag, and if you had more than one, that you might have to pay for it. And, you know, they gave you water on the plane and fed you. But now they make the announcement. Oh, if you want to eat on this, you know, intercontinental flight, you're going to have to spend $25 for a meal of carpet.
And no cash.
Yes.
Excellent. Yeah. All right. I am with you on that in this regard, that because I don't do a lot of, like, international, like, most of my flights are pretty, you know, like, I'll go from here to California, or from, like, I'm going to Utah or whatever. My thing is, now, is it true that they now charge you, or they do something, like, if you want to have a carry-on, or, like, if you're just doing carry-on, if you're not checking the luggage, or if I got it backwards, because I never check anything, ever. I compress my entire life down to one bag, and, like, maybe my laptop or whatever. I hate waiting for luggage. My whole thing is point A to point B, so I always carry everything on with me. But somebody, it might have been Dawn, mentioned that they're working on some way to screw people who don't check their luggage.
What they're trying to do is they're trying to keep you from doing exactly what you're talking about doing. So I don't know. I haven't heard of them trying to charge you for carry-ons, but they're becoming more and more stringent about the size of your carry-on and how many you can – because there's a lot of people who, you know – It's like the big fat person wearing the Speedo at the beach. It's like, really, you can't fit into that thing, you know.
It's so. Like the tensile strength is really just being tested in every way.
Yeah. So, but flying just it has gotten, you know, you buy your bottle of water outside the security gate and it's $1.
Right.
Inside the security gate, it's $14.50. And you know, but they won't let you carry the water through.
I don't know. Did I tell you this? Did I tell you my plan for when I'm flying to Utah? Did I tell you what I'm going to wear?
No.
All right. So my wife, God bless her, is a wonderfully tolerant person. She understands my rather juvenile approach to many aspects of my life, and I like to think that I warned her, like, up front, because I have so many just like the number of terrible, like failed relationships. I mean, totally my fault, by the way, because I am the common denominator in all of them. The number of bad, horrible breakups that I endured and that I inflicted on other people only by not sufficiently warning them in advance of what an idiot I am. You know, where it's like they sort of say, like, you know, you're not mentally defective in any way. You're not really just. What is the thing of spinal tap? You're not treading water in a sea of retarded development, are you? And I say, no, baby, of course not. I'm a fully developed, I'm a very mature human being. Rick Emerson's all man. And then, no. And so it would just sort of obliterate. But when Laura and I got together, I tried to be like, look, here's everything bad about me. Because she was, you know, she was so great. And I'm like, okay, this is either going to end badly, like, you know, later, you know, or now, or maybe not at all. So I'm going to find out which it is, like, on our first date. And so just, like, I tried to just say, like, look, I seem charming now, and I'm wearing my pants and everything, and I'm not covered in stains. Here's the thing about me, though. And just tried to, you know, just to lay out the, like, when I turn into a pumpkin. And so she sort of, you know, went into it fully aware. And so, you know, she's, you know, really, really great and doesn't inflict things like Utah trips on me that often. And when she does, she knows that I have a real problem with, like, you know, like the airport security guys and the take off your shoes and the whatever. And I don't actually do anything illegal. I never do anything that's going to get me, like, taken out back and tased or anything. But I have tried to, like, every time sort of ramp up the number of small sort of passive annoyances that I can inflict on the TSA people. My most recent is she went to Turkey in October, and she came back with a lot of T-shirts for me, because I'm a big, you know, T-shirt wearer. And one of them is the Turkish flag, which is just a huge red crescent and star, which is actually the national – it is the flag of Turkey, also from the Ottoman Empire and the Romans at one point. So it's a huge Turkish flag of star and a crescent. And then – but here's the thing. That's the layer underneath. The layer on top, Aaron Duran at geekinthecity.com used to sell this thing that I think is now discontinued. It's a replica of the sweatshirt from Die Hard after McClane sends the guy down the elevator, and it says, now I have a machine gun, ho, ho, ho.
Oh, God.
It's awesome. It's like the single best, and I'm not a sweatshirt wearer, but because it's, you know, because like a tacky gray fleece, and then it's like the font looks just like the blood font from Die Hard. So I bought that like years ago, way before any of this like jazz at the airport. So now I figure it's wintertime. It's a Die Hard quote. That's a holiday movie. I'm going to wear the Die Hard machine gun shirt with then like the crescent shirt, you know, underneath it, just to sort of see like how interesting it makes my trip.
Are you also going to sort of use some instant tan and darken up your skin tone and maybe walk through with a handgun?
Just like phonetically learn some Arabic phrases. You know, but something really like, you know, something really like, you know, really just ridiculous. Like, you know, okay, I love the taste of deep fried furniture. Just something that makes no sense, you know? Anyway,
you are a man after my own heart, Mr. Emerson. You really are.
This is why I keep getting this is why I keep getting fired, by the way, because
happy anniversary.
Thank you. Because we are an hour and 20 minutes into this program, and I think we've gotten like, oh, I don't know, nothing done. But by the way, you don't even know, because you were, I don't know if you were here for our Twitter conversation earlier. David and I are both really we're both really inept at using Twitter, and I was saying that you use it quite a lot, and you seem to have a handle onto that, and I don't like the whole hashtag thing was confusing, and somebody, a listener, called and tried to explain it, and
he was just a baker.
But at the end of the call, like, I asked him one question too many, and he went like, "I'm just a baker," and he hung up.
Somebody, hashtag, I'm just a baker.
Okay. See, here's the thing. Somebody just now, and thank you to whoever brought this to my attention, Twitter user at Jonathan EG has just Twittered, like, nothing in particular, just so he could put the hashtag ignorant radio host. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. That means a great deal.
I am getting the sense now that Dawn is kind of the glue that holds this show together.
I have said many times that any endeavor, any project, anything I am working on where it looks like I am competent or accomplished or organized in any way, there is a woman who is helping to make me look much better than I really, really am. During the hours of broadcast of this show, that is Dawn. The behind the scenes of this program, that is Cheryl. At Outlook Portland, that is Cheryl. In terms of my clothing and how I dress and my appearance, that is actually not even really so much my wife. That is Sarah Dillon. You know, in terms of my learning how to be a socially proper individual and how to have some modicum of decorum, that's my wife. you know, anything, any of my various film projects, you know, anything I've ever done, there's always been somebody there to sort of prop me up.
So we are the Wendy to your Peter Pan. Is that
That's
where we are?
Yes. You're the Edgar Bergen. you know, and I'm just
well, that just gets ooky.
The funny guy with a monocle. All right. Well, in any event, how are you, Anna Griffin? How's life?
I'm great. Thank you. Nice to be here. Picked up an electric chair since the last time I was here.
I'm sorry?
There's an electric chair on
oh my God.
The table here.
I didn't even really... I think I must have missed that. Sitting in the middle of the table, is that Marv from Sin City? David Walker, you probably know that.
Yes, that is Marv.
Okay,
and there's actually a kill switch there, too.
Hold on. If I press this...
Whoa, oh,
Jesus,
my goodness.
God,
things
almighty.
Happen.
Wow. Do not want...
It is not a visual medium, and yet...
And it's not stopping, either.
And it can't be turned off. Oh, wow. Okay. No one... Okay, don't do whatever... That's the button you don't press.
Yeah.
Jesus. All right, so there's an 8-inch tall, very detailed, I mean, really lovely in a sort of horrific way. Not a statue, what'd you call it?
A sculpture.
Of Marv from Sin City in the electric chair. And then you press the switch, yeah, and then it vibrates, and there's a screaming noise that comes out.
His, rather his eyes light up red.
And there's a card with it. Well, I'll open
this. Did you
this.
Not realize this was there until I pointed it out?
It's been a bit of a day here. look, I've had all these really groundbreaking bits of comedy about airline food to do.
What is the deal with
I don't
peanuts?
Know. I don't know if you've noticed the genius that's been created here over the last hour or two, but that doesn't just happen by itself.
I was explaining to somebody the last time I was on that it is like watching Philippe Petit, you know, dance between the towers, just watching where you go. And usually you make it back safely. And I'm more concerned today than usual.
Yeah,
it's a lot of it's my fault, though. I have this effect on people. We Court and Fatboy on Tuesday, we managed to go 45 minutes without talking about anything before we realized, oh, the show's over in 15.
I mean, you know, that is the that, and I have had, you know, over the years, and the weird thing is, I mean, not to just go on and on about me, but I will say that I, you know, because I've been in Portland for going to be 13 years doing the show, and I have over time just learned out of necessity to reverse engineer a program built around my various faults and flaws and my relative lack of talent. As opposed to changing myself to fit the format of radio and the structure that radio sometimes requires, I have actually just created a program whose whole – it's like building a tool shed out back to cover the septic tank that you can't get rid of. You know what I mean? And so instead you just make it like a petunia bed. And this show is the petunia bed. It's almost hard to believe that I didn't last very long on KUFO where the talk segments had to be kept down to like 90 seconds at a time. Jesus. Coming up later on today, we'll do a top five, which is the top five songs to which you would sulk and brood as a teen.
Yes.
And we had to start with that one because that's your first top five. And we always say that it's so emotionally wrecking sometimes for certain people. And I think you did it as well, did you?
I did. I did, I believe, two of them. Yes.
And, I mean, it's difficult territory emotionally to mine sometimes.
Yes, because I did a Valentine's Day one. I did, like, the top five songs to break up with somebody to or something like that.
That was a happy day.
Yeah.
So we always figured if you can make it through that, then you're able to sort of, you know, then you can handle anything. Because that's the top five that seems to give people the most agita in terms of...
Just coming up with five was fairly traumatic.
What are you doing for the holidays? Because I think you actually, did you write a piece about the TSA lately?
I'm working on something
for
Saturday. I went out to the airport yesterday and found myself in a room with six TSA screeners.
Okay, so now I am the jackass who...
Because I know you're
on their side. And I am the jackass that causes trouble.
Just doing their jobs.
I know.
I do. They were nice enough to give me a travel tip.
What? Which is?
The travel tip is Portland International Airport is so well designed that it doesn't matter which gate you're going to. You can go through either side for security.
Really?
Because there's a corridor connecting them.
I didn't know that.
Uh-huh.
So why do they – now, that's weird – why – I was going to ask why they have it split up to – why they make it so you have to go through – two of them, why they don't just say pick a gate, but I guess they do that so they can manage the flow
exactly.
of the foot traffic.
But if you show up and one D, E, and F, or however they divide the two wings, is very crowded, just turn around and go through security the other way.
That is, see, right there, you people, that is worth your 32 cents a day right there. That is, I mean, if you ever ask yourself, like, you know, 32 cents a day for this, they're not even saying anything. Hashtag waste of money. This, you, now, see, that time has gone because Anna Griffin has passed along, you know, knowledge that you did not previously have. Well done.
Thank you very much.
So you went out, you, and is it like, this is obviously prompted by the whole backscatter thing, the whole, you know,
the scanning and the patting down, and the, I wanted to go and see basically what kind of grief they had heard over Thanksgiving.
Did they say that anybody did, because we don't have the whole body scan thing here, so we probably didn't have like a lot of the opt-out thing, but did they say that people were really giving them a lot of guff?
They said people, it was more apprehension than, because people just didn't know what to expect.
Right.
But they said, you know, they pointed out that like so many other things, that Portlanders are just really polite. And so they didn't get as much crap as they think their
counterparts
elsewhere did.
Yeah. It does also help, by the way, and I should say this, as much as I understand they're doing their job. Don't get me wrong. I know that there's just some guy, he's just trying to pay the rent and whatever. But it's... You know, and I know that the guy who really makes the decision about all of this inanity that we have to do at the airport, that's not the guy who's at the airport. I mean, he is the guy who makes a decision somewhere else, and I'll never get a chance to yell at him. So I try not to take it out, you know, on the guy who is, as you say, just doing his job. When it's like occasionally it's just so irritating that you feel like you just don't have any choice. Or it's, I feel like I just like I because I try not to be. That guy, because everybody, it's like you see somebody who has a, like, nobody wants to be, like, what's your job? Well, I kneel down and I feel some guy's junk for, you know, $9 an hour.
It happens to you once. He has to do it 500 times a day.
There was a photograph, I forget who sent this to me, somebody sent it, it was called, like, who has it worse in this photo? And it was a picture of a guy flying on the day before Thanksgiving at, like, I don't know, like JFK or something. And it was a guy standing there with, like, you know, in the kind of classic Jesus Christ pose with his legs kind of spread, arms out. And then there's another guy who sort of looked like Milton from Office Space, all gloved up. And then his hand, like, I don't know where, but it was the hand was, like, right up in the business. And it's like, you're like, well, who really has the worst end of this lollipop here? Like, it's hard to say.
Out on 82nd Avenue, you get paid $100 for that.
Yeah, but, I mean, there you can pick your clientele, you know? So I'm told. You can, you know, that's a thing that, like, you know, you could just say, no, go home and shower, then we'll talk. You know, at the airport, you know, the guys come up and it's like they just say, well, I guess inspect me. And then they unbuckle. And then you're just sitting there looking at the floor going, this is my life. So I try not to be obnoxious, but it just annoys me so much.
Well, the entire process of flying is, I mean, we're entitled Americans, so we think it should be an easy, painless thing. If I show up an hour before my flight,
right.
I am clearly not a terrorist. There's clearly, even though I'm carrying everything I own through security with me because I don't want to pay $25 for my bag, you can trust me. I should be able to get on my plane without lickety-split.
Part of me feels like I ought to be given the option. Like, I could sort of, like, there ought to be some special line you can go through.
You have an option not to fly.
Well, see, people say that, and I understand that in theory, that, you know, there's the free market system, and if you don't like a business, you don't have to shop there. I understand that that is true sort of in the abstract, but in actual real life, that is de facto not true. I mean, that's
well, you could go Greyhound and pick who pats you down.
I mean, I guess that's like saying that I don't, you know, I don't have to have a phone, but you kind of have to have a phone. So, David Walker?
I just came up with this brilliant idea that, you know, they're charging extra for bags. They should have the, you can get patted down by this guy for free, or you can pay, and they'll have like some supermodel looking Hooters girls. Or
$50. And the lights will go down and you'll be behind a screen.
Yeah.
See, now what I was going to say is that there ought to be, we're all sort of on the same page here. I was thinking that there ought to be some line you can go through where they're not going to pat you down, they're not going to screen you, you don't have to do any of that jazz. But it's like you also have to like cede the right to sue for anything. Like, there's no liability. If anything happens, you know, if a guy in the plane just goes crazy with a fish scaler and just goes after everybody, then that's, you know, you have waived, you've signed on saying, look, I know things may go poorly. Things may go wrong on this flight.
What was amazing in this conversation, because I'm a lot like you, it's like flying is just a pain in the neck and it should not be this hard. What was amazing was to hear how many people, even 10 years after 9/11 almost, still try to bring, say, loaded handguns on the plane with them.
See, and that's just hilarious to me. The idea that that's like simply out of in self-preservation terms, you think you would know not to do that.
Well, I would tend to agree with you. I mean, the problem is not, you know, the three of us in here right now, we're not idiots. And so the problem is the vast majority of this country is populated by complete idiots who will do things like bring an open container of, you know, kerosene and some oily rags on the plane with them and then think, well, wait a sec, why can't I bring my lighter, too? I want to go into the bathroom where there's no smoking and light up.
They told me a story of a woman who bag goes through the X-ray. There is a loaded handgun in her handbag. She has enough time to go back to her car and put the handbag in her car, but still tries to bring the bullets through.
Wow. I mean, it's, you know, and those people vote. That's the thing. They vote, and they have lots of kids that grow up to vote. God almighty. So this is coming out, in print when?
Saturday. Saturday.
What else is going on in your life, Anna Griffin?
You know, buying holiday presents, preparing for 2011.
Do you begin shopping early? Do you have the family thing where you buy for everybody, or is it that you get the communal present for the family and then like, you know, like stocking things or whatever, and just, you know, so you can sort of, because, you know, otherwise it just rages out. Like if you get a big family, it just, either the cost, it just enters like, you know, yeah, it enters like quadruple digits really
quickly.
You know,
I decreed for a while, I have family on the East Coast and then my younger brother's on the West Coast, and so I was hosting Christmas, and a couple of years ago I just announced that it was too stressful and I just can't no more. And
right.
So we've cut down a lot, but then there's you have to mail things. Like my mother this year, her passive aggressive response to I don't want to host Christmas in Portland is she's going on a Caribbean cruise for 2 weeks during Christmas. So got to get her gifts in the mail before she leaves. And her gifts are all arriving in boxes now. And my children know what it is. I mean, they know that Grandma shops at that intimate boutique called Amazon. So they have learned at 4 and 7 that an Amazon box probably means something for them. And so there's can we open it? Can we open it? Can we open it? Can we open it?
No. And so I know that your family has been they've been on the Wii. They've been on the Wii front.
My son is 7 and is I don't have official stats, but is apparently the only child in Portland who does not have a Wii at this point.
Really? Was he kind enough to inform you of that fact?
On a daily basis, yes.
He's done some sort of quantitative study, and he has determined that is, in fact, the case.
And what he does not understand is that the reason we are not allowed to have a Wii is because I would play it all the time, and that would drive my spouse insane.
Ah, that's the thing. Okay. So this is you have learned. It's a weird thing. I was thinking about this the other day, actually, how video games, like the video game industry, they have sort of figured out where their bread is buttered. Because when I was growing up, there was no, like, video games were not really targeted at adults. They were considered almost solely a kid thing. And as video games have evolved and as society has, you know, as we've gone on, they have actually, I mean, it's not like kids don't play them, and they certainly, you know, target them kids to some degree. But the average, like the mean age of the video game player has gone to like 29 or something now, or 34, where it is, you know, which is a thing that my parents never, you know, like when I was a kid, it's like if you were an adult who played a video game, like there was, you know, you were certainly the exception, you know, and people sometimes thought there was something a little wrong with you.
My mother would not have been caught dead playing Call of Duty, no.
No, she would not. So it has, you know, and the thing about the Wii is that it has a strange, I don't see this with the PlayStation, but with the Wii and with the Xbox, they both have a strangely addictive power over different kinds of people. The people who will get hooked on Xbox stuff, they're not the kind of the same as the people who get hooked on Wii things. I think it's because it's a different kind of a game. But guys who use it are like hooked on Black Ops, which, I mean, and it's like, I'll have to read this to you, actually. I get the single best email. I think it's actually the best email I've received all week, and it has to do with Black Ops. I've got it right here, actually. Our good friend Seamus says about Black Ops. Hey, Rick, I thought you'd like to know I put in just under 240 hours of Black Ops since it came out about a month ago. That's more than 8 hours per day. I dream about Black Ops. I think about Black Ops. I strategize Black Ops in my head when I'm not playing it. The moment I wake up, I start playing Black Ops. I only pause to eat and work, and since I work from home, sometimes I don't even pause for that. Tell no one. I have played so much Black Ops that my eyes feel like they have been rubbed down with sandpaper. I just now finally stopped myself so I could find something else to do in a few hours so I could give my eyes a rest because they hurt so bad that I couldn't get any kills in the game. I might have to go pick up some of the eye drops from Walgreens just so I could keep playing, he says. I should point out, by the way, This is the guy we've known for a long time. He is a fantastically intelligent and accomplished individual. And they have found the sort of chink in his mental armor. They have. It is like the dealer who finally discovers the combination of drugs that he can sell you.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think he actually sent me like a text message or something for being in line to get the game. And then it was like maybe 9 hours he had already beaten the game because he'd gone home and just done some sort of like weird, you know, like Asperger type hyper focus on it. So we are really living in just the strangest time. It really is a very strange time to be alive.
But you're right. The Wii is, do they even have real shoot 'em up games for the Wii?
No, I think Nintendo has typically, I mean, they may have changed it, but Nintendo has typically been, they have eschewed a lot of the sort of violent video games. There was a thing called, and this is a thing about, I can speak way too much about this, but there was there's a book called Game Over by David Sheff, who's an author. He writes for Playboy a lot, and he does a lot of articles for Sports Illustrated, I believe. But he wrote this book called Game Over about the rise of Nintendo and then the eventual sort of implosion of Nintendo and the, you know, the competition they faced. But one of the real turning points in the evolution of video games in America was this thing called Mortal Monday. And Mortal Monday was a day back in, I guess, 1990, would have been the early 90s when Mortal Kombat came out for the home system. And the real line of demarcation was that Mortal Kombat, which was differentiated from other fighting games by your ability to, let's say, pull out somebody's spine or...
And lord it over them. That was the best part.
It was the taunting, really. Yeah. That was like spiking the ball, you know? It was sort of a monk's like pulling out of it and then holding your enemy's still beating heart. It was like Aztec the game. But when Nintendo put it out, they removed all of the finishing options. You couldn't do that anymore. And it was like, you know, you would finish the guy off, and then it's like he would just kind of go like, ow, and then he would sort of fall over, and that was kind of it. That was like as far as it went. But Sega went the full 9 yards, where they had the full, like, you know, brutal thing going on, and they said that was a real turning point in the game because Nintendo was opting for... they were opting for a family-friendly approach to gaming, and Sega wasn't. And Nintendo has really stuck with that, though, because they feel like, as you said, that it's a thing that you could get for the entire family, whether you're getting it for your kid or for, you know, for mom or whoever, that everybody can sort of – nobody can really object to Nintendo. You know, it's not a thing you can really find fault with. As opposed to Xbox, which, again, you know, you're basically there in the NAM. You know, Agent Orging the underbrush.
I have a PSP, and my son about 6 months ago figured out it wasn't a BlackBerry, and that's cut down on my shooting time.
Yeah.
And I like shooting things; I just enjoy it.
What is your game of choice?
Oh, I'm actually playing this flying game, Ace of Combat, the new Ace game. I'm shooting planes now.
Excellent.
I enjoy that.
I have this whole weird. This is where my strange sort of. Like I have this, I'm like a sort of philosophical Aquafresh toothpaste, and then I have these stripes of hyper liberalism, and that alternates though with patterns of like I just don't care, like I don't give a rip about you know like the whales can fight their own battles because I got stuff I'm doing, so it's like it just depends on what day you catch me and what issue it is. There doesn't seem to be really any overarching theme. But my wife last year for Christmas actually brought home Modern Warfare 2, Call of Duty. And it's like – and don't get me wrong. I love to shoot things. Shooting things, blowing things up, explosions of any variety. You know, Rick Emerson is generally in favor of those things. But I played Call of Duty. I played Modern Warfare 2 for about an hour. And I actually had to stop because it made me really uneasy. I just felt really like – I felt very morally ambiguous about it. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it. I don't believe that there's – you know, that it's immoral or whatever. I'm saying it is just a me thing. Because a lot of the guys I know who are veterans or who are in the service, they all love it. They think it's awesome. It made me feel a little wonky, though, that you weren't like in a fictitious place. You were actually in like Fallujah, going down the road just like machine gunning everybody.
It feels different if you're shooting Nazis versus shooting people who could be alive now.
Okay, here's the thing. And so this, I'm so glad you said this. I could talk, again, I could just go on for decades about this. Nazis and?
And?
Who else can you shoot that's vaguely humanoid?
No, zombies.
Exactly.
Yeah, I just had this conversation with someone the other day, actually. Resident Evil sort of brought the zombie from the underground cult status to mainstream because it was like shooting a person but not shooting a
person.
That's
the thing. So the zombie target, it sort of satisfies, I think, this sort of primal desire borne out by, by the tens of millions of years of evolving next to a campfire and having to fight for your place in this world, both within, with intraspecies and extra-species combat. It satisfies, man's inherent desire for some sort of combat or strife or violence, which is probably there, to some degree in everybody. Yet you can feel okay about it because it's not Bob, it's Zombie Bob.
Yeah.
Just like a Nazi. It's not Bob, it's Nazi Bob. And like, who cares? F him. He's a Nazi.
Yeah,
die.
I don't like the zombie thing.
See,
it makes me uncomfortable.
Because
Zombie Bob used to be Bob.
Yeah, but I mean, that was, look.
And Nazi is just Fritz. I mean, that's...
I suppose. But I mean, it seems like either being a Nazi or a zombie, that's a binary state, baby. Once you go there, you're not coming back. There's no... I don't care what the new Pope says. You were a Nazi then. You're still a Nazi, in my opinion. Ain't no cure for Nazi. No cure for the zombie virus. You write that down. Just break that out at cocktail parties.
There's another hashtag. Ain't no cure for Nazi.
That's, I mean, there's a 45 caliber cure for that. That's how you solve that.
Nazi zombies now.
Things that would sound really manly and aggressive from other people just don't work for me. I say it and it just falls flat. Just lands on the ground like a soggy matzah. Just sits there. We're going to take a break now and just try to get some toehold, some tenuous grasp of control. We have a show like this about once every 3 months where it's not bad as such. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with today's show, per se.
There are 12 people out there loving this.
It's just, but they're loving it. They're hella loving it. But we will have a show about every 90 days where it's like everything is just, there is no linear pattern. It is just entropy incarnate. And there's really no structure, or logical coherence to be found in any way. But, everybody's got to be good at something. So we'll take a break. We'll come back. Get a few more news stories. We'll do your top five, the top five songs to which you would brood as a teenager, and more. Don't forget to join us tomorrow on the Rick Emerson Radio Program, and our guest will include Mr. Big Jim Willig. We'll be here with another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101. So that is coming up tomorrow. You are listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Stay there, won't you, please?
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas. Where the treetops glisten and kiddies listen to hear
sleigh bells in the snow.
Of a white Christmas. Give me the way.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. By the way, for folks who've asked about that, so that is one of the more popular Christmas songs that we play every year. That is it's an artist called Corporal Blossom, and it's a thing that I think is actually at a print. I don't know that it can be obtained anymore, but it is, I believe, 36 different versions of White Christmas that they have sort of blended together. So that that may or may not be purchasable. I think that is a thing that was sold, then has subsequently been removed from audio sales sites across the globe. You are listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program here at the Emerson News Network. Coming up, we'll have the top five for today. Anna Griffin is here. We'll do the top five songs to which she sulked as a teenager. We have more news for Mr. David Walker, including a Hick watch, and we'll do either the Darwin watch or the do we have a clown watch over there as well?
There is a clown watch, but the clown watch, the Hick watch is a good one.
Really?
Yeah, I would go with the Hick and the Darwin, but you're the boss. So.
Well, you know, I'm just saying, I want to. Part of me, see, I'm of two minds on this. Part of me really wants to wait and do the clown watch when Dawn is back.
Yeah,
you know, because I mean, really, that's like a tree falling in the forest thing. Like, what is the point of doing the clown watch if she's not here to be terrified of it?
There, and I would agree with that. I would, and I don't want to take that away from you or from her.
Let me just tell you this: if you ever want to weird somebody out, like if you know anybody who's got a fear of clowns, and you don't share the fear of
no.
clowns, so like zombies maybe are to you as clowns are to you know.
No, a zombie clown would be terrifying.
Seriously, Left 4 Dead 2, zombie clowns. No lie. At one point, you're going through like an amusement park, and clearly something, by something I mean the zombie virus, was there before you. And it's like they just come rushing out of the dark. You don't even see them. You just hear sort of a hiss and then kind of a squall. And then suddenly there it's like just you know, grease paint and claws, like from nowhere. So Dawn is the real clown fear. I might actually wait to do that when she's back, you know? Just to help put a sort of horrible smile on her face. If you ever want to unnerve somebody who has the clown fear, have them go to Google Images, and you just type in Day of the Clown. You type in Day of the Clown at Google Images. Because apparently in Mexico, there is a celebration that they have every year, the Day of the Clown, where people, by the thousands, apparently, dress up as clowns and then just sort of plunge into the streets to amuse and or terrify people in traffic. Because I guess they just run things a little differently down there. So you go and really just Google that image, the Day of the Clown, and it's like the first thing that comes up is so deeply unsettling that it'll probably stay with you for the better part of the day. So I heartily recommend that. I really do. The Rick Emerson Show comes to you today courtesy of Christmas Mountain Trees. You can find out more about Christmas Mountain Trees by going to their website, which is just christmasmountaintrees.com. And they have a Facebook page as well. That is facebook.com/Christmas Mountain. And we actually went up there this past Saturday. It was actually Dawn and Cheryl and Bruce Agler and myself. We all went up there, and it was really just... It really was just a fantastic time. I mean, it was just exceptional. It's a family farm. It's been in the family for three decades, going on four, and it is just what it sounds like. It is a family farm where they grow Christmas trees year round. It's what they do, and there are, as I have said now many many times, there are 85,000 trees in this place, and it's you don't really fathom how that's possible until you get up there. And it's just a wonderful experience. So if you've got kids or family, or you and your significant other looking for a way to do, you want to do something for Christmas that echoes in some way the Christmases that you have always imagined or that you've seen or that you have been depicted, you know, on television, you go there and you're, for once in your life, you're actually going to have something where the reality of that Christmas experience equals what you want it to be. I will read to you now this email that came from a listener named Jason. I got this morning. It said, Rick, I wanted to let you know that as a listener, I try to do my part by utilizing the offerings and or services of your advertisers. I know that by buying these things, I am helping to keep you talking for my entertainment, just like the radio monkey you love to be. Today, my boyfriend and I went to Christmas Mountain Trees, and we had a great time. He continues, weekdays are definitely the best. No rain, but friendly, helpful, and eager staff. That would be Troy and his wife, Jennifer, also brother-in-law, Kevin, who's a great guy in his own right. He said, we took our time selecting the right tree, chatting with the owner. I only wish, and I'm not advocating that you do this. This is Jason saying this. Rick Emerson isn't condoning this sort of... He says, I only wish that I had taken my flask with me for the ride out to look at the trees. It was the best Christmas tree hunting we have ever had since I lived in Portland, and I have been here for 18 years. I wanted to let you know that he, Troy, spoke fondly of his experience with you and Saturday. Sorry we couldn't be there, but thank you for the recommendation. Regardless, longtime listener, Jason. So there you go. So I can't say it any better than that. I can't give you a stronger recommendation than that of a listener, Jason, who went there and had a great time. Find out more by going to ChristmasMountainTrees.com or go to Facebook.com/ChristmasMountain. You can find out more about it right there. They are a proud sponsor of the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Open till December 19th, Christmas Mountain Trees.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
Santa Claus goes straight to the ghetto. Hitch up your reindeer and go straight to the ghetto. Santa Claus go straight to the ghetto. Fill every stocking you find. The kids are gonna love you so. Leave a toy for Johnny. Leave a doll for Mary. Leave something pretty for Donnie. And don't forget about Gary. Santa Claus go straight to the ghetto. Santa Claus goes straight to the ghetto. Tell him James Brown sent you. Go straight to the ghetto. You know that I know what you will see, 'cause that was once me. Hit it, hit it. You see mothers and soul brothers. Santa Claus goes straight to the ghetto. Santa Claus, oh Lord, goes straight to the ghetto. Fill every stocking you find. The kids are gonna love you so. Fill every stocking you find. They know that they need you so. I'm begging you, Santa Claus, go straight to the ghetto. If anyone wanna know, tell them Hank Ballard told so. Santa Claus, go straight to the ghetto. Never thought I'd realize I'd be singing a song with water in my eyes. Santa Claus, go straight to the ghetto. Nothing for me. I've had my chance, you see. Santa Claus, go straight to the ghetto. Santa Claus, a soul brother needs so. Santa Claus.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. It is Thursday, December 9th, 2010. Don't forget to join us tomorrow when our guests will include Mr. Big Jim Willig with another installment of Humor Me, Comedy 101. That is coming up tomorrow on the Rick Emerson Radio Program. And I am consulting my notes right now to see exactly what his subject is tomorrow. Tomorrow he will be talking about the life, legacy, and comedy of Carol Burnett. So that is tomorrow, following up on last week's Don Rickles discussion. Tomorrow, Carol Burnett on Humor Me Comedy 101 with Big Jim Willig. You can find out more about him at Facebook.com/Jim Willig. We are here with Anna Griffin from The Oregonian. So you've got the TSA piece coming up. Is it? Let me ask you this. Do you work on just one piece at a time, or are you writing multiple pieces concurrently?
I usually have many, many pieces going at once.
Really? Is that how long? All things being equal, if it's not like a breaking news story, how long does it take you to turn a story around? Like something like this, let's say. How much total time behind the keyboard, you know, do you spend kind of hashing everything together?
Oh, this piece, I mean, I spent a couple hours reporting yesterday, and the writing will take me either just a moment or forever, depending on... I'm a fast writer, so 625 words to get a draft down would probably take me an hour once I've... But it's the writing is not the hard part. It's the thinking before the writing and during the writing that is difficult.
Is it one of those things where it either comes in like a flood all at once or it just takes you like forever?
Yes. Yeah, that's how... And everybody's different who writes for a living, but it's one of those... If I've got it, it's a pretty quick process.
But if you're not, it's just like...
And so much of it is the thought that goes into it, as just sort of the figuring out in advance, what is it I'm trying to say?
Right. You know, David's a writer, too, and I am so fascinated by... this is a thing that I may have asked you this before, maybe not. Do you have a set schedule? I mean, obviously, you know, the Oregon is, you know, I don't know, it's not a 9-to-5 business as such, but it's an office and it's whatever. But in terms of your writing and your productivity and when you can sort of do that, do you have a routine or a time that you stick to?
I don't have a time that I stick to. I should. I mean, I think that would be, I am not the most disciplined professional, but I have certain times a day that I'm better. And they usually don't coincide to the workday.
is that a thing where once like 11 p.m. rolls around, like suddenly your synapses are firing?
It's about 8:30 at night. Yeah, there's a period right after my children go to bed when I handwrite a lot of stuff.
One golden, glorious, you know, swath of time in the evening. Where
I hear the trumpets and I see the world a little clearer, and I smell things that I couldn't smell before. Yeah.
When you are writing, do you get to a point like if you're working at night, do you get to a point where then it just suddenly... You talk about this story sometimes just coming out like all at once. Does that then just switch off at some point too if you're writing? Do you just suddenly like you finish a sentence and you go, ah, and your brain is just sort of, you're at the end of your writing time for that day?
You know, it doesn't usually happen to me, although I know people who it works that way. For me, it's more the challenge is getting the momentum built. And once the momentum is built, I can follow something through to the end. But it's sort of the... getting started is the issue.
Push starting the car.
That was a weird noise I just made.
It really was. I wasn't going to make. I wasn't going to point that out, but I'm glad you did now.
I'm grunting for no reason.
It was a little awkward for everybody here. You are listening to the Rick Emerson radio program under the top five here in just a few. At the news desk, we'll have.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
Filling in for Dawn Taylor, who is in the hospital attending to her husband, Patrick, who is undergoing a series of tests, really unpleasant tests. We'll just put it that way. I think we actually discussed this earlier on a Legion of News. Yesterday, we thought the time yesterday of putting, how did she describe it? Putting things that were very large into things that were very small, we thought that was going to be confined to Wednesday. And apparently, no, not so much. So that is continuing on today. So so our thoughts are with Patrick and with Dawn today. She, I know, is spending a lot of time kind of sitting in the hallway or in the hospital room itself, just having long, long periods of boredom punctuated by moments of terror. So she is, I think she's posting some stuff to Facebook and Twitter throughout the day. So if you can contact her there if you want to. I know that she would appreciate hearing from y'all. In for Dawn Taylor, this is Mr. David Walker.
All right, let's kick this off with a Hick Watch.
Here is your Hick Watch for Thursday on the Rick Emerson Radio program.
Makes me feel so good. Yeah. Well, I put a little chew in my mouth, go spitting, slobbering all around the house. That Copenhagen makes me feel so good. Oh, yeah.
Excellent. Here is David Walker with your Hick Watch for this Thursday.
Bartlesville, Oklahoma.
Bartlesville.
Bartlesville. That tells it. That says so much.
Right next to Jamestown.
A 41-year-old Oklahoma man was arraigned in Washington County District Court on Monday for DUI, leaving the scene of an accident, driving under suspension, and assault on an officer as he was rearrested for reportedly being drunk after he fell down before the judge. A short time later, Mark Watson failed a breathalyzer test administered by sheriff's deputies. The initial charges stemmed from Watson's arrest early Monday morning after he reportedly had been involved in a hit-and-run crash in Bartlesville. Now, Bartlesville's police were investigating the 2:28 a.m. crash. They found Watson's vehicle and questioned him. In the probable cause affidavit filed with the court, Watson told officers, "I'm effing drunk." I don't think he actually said effing, though. I think he said something else. "I'm effing drunk. I was driving, but I did not run the stop sign. That effing hit me.
Really?
Yes.
Well, again, you know, I mean, if you're really going to make a full-throated defense, I mean, do it all the way. You stick with it.
Oh, but it gets better. The affidavit goes on to say that Watson refused to take a blood and breath test, telling the officers, "I ain't taking no effing tests. I'm effing drunk. I'm blind anyways, and I can't drive."
He sort of was undone by the continuing conversation that he held with the officers there.
Yes.
Like, if he had just stuck with the sign, "hit me," like, okay, that's implausible, but at least he's got one story, and that is the direction he's going. Then you have to, you know, then he's hoisted by his own petard by revealing that he is, I'm sorry, what, blind?
"I'm blind anyways, and I can't drive."
He's blind anyways, so he was not able to go the 5 or 6 mile that they may have claimed.
Yes.
I don't even know where to start with this. So I'm blind anyway, and I can't drive. This after he hit the thing, and then he actually fell down in the courtroom.
Yeah, he's not denying that he was driving the car.
Right.
He's not denying that he was drunk. He just refused to take the test. And apparently, you know, the being drunk and hitting, or the sign hitting him, wasn't as big a deal as the fact that he's blind and can't drive.
You figure that he might have, you know, this is sort of like when they pull you over for speeding, but you've got, you know, like 70 pounds of hash in the trunk, and you think, I probably don't want them to see that. Maybe I'll just be really polite and accept the ticket.
I wasn't stupid enough to speed. I have 70 tons of pot in the backseat.
That's the thing.
Are you effing kidding me?
So this guy, you know, like if you're in a car and driving and also, you know, you're blind, you figure that maybe that's a thing you'd like to keep from the man. And so, you know, when they say, "Did you hit the sign?" You go, "Yes, I did. Boy, to heck with me, boy. I don't know what's going on today. Oh, I'm a little bit drunk as well." Because as bad as those are, when you add in the hat trick of, "Oh, hey, I'm blind."
And I'm 12. And
it seems like that's a thing where you spend a lot of time in a small windowless room over the next few months.
Well, and he also allegedly kicked an officer while he was being arrested.
And maybe he just figured that this was like, you know, this was the last act of his...
In for a penny, in for a pound.
Yeah, sort of. This was going to be the last chapter of his storied criminal career. And so really, why not make it a blaze of glory in which he goes out?
Apparently the DA is going to file additional charges.
And this took place where?
This is in Bartlesville, Oklahoma, which is in Washington County,
Note
Oklahoma.
Note to self, so, yes. do not drive there. All right, there you go. There's your Hick Watch. Awesome. Oklahoma seems to generate a lot of our stories about people in vehicles, lawnmowers, occasionally stealing a Zamboni. Some guy stole a Zamboni a couple weeks ago because they were out of booze. This might have actually been in Fargo. A lot of these things seem to happen in North Dakota
I mean, a Zamboni, you can understand.
Well, they didn't want to be responsible and drive a car because they were drinking all day and then they ran out.
What kind of damage could you do in a Zamboni?
Well, as it turns out, more than you might anticipate. I don't know how much you're envisioning, but I think it's probably substantially
off
beyond that.
Off the ice.
Yeah. They didn't want to, you know, Vince Neil has taught us that, you know, you send somebody for the alcohol or just, you know, maybe just walk or something. But they didn't want to get in the car, so they stole a Zamboni. And it's like the Zamboni went
off. How do you even steal a Zamboni?
That's the thing, is like we were saying, like you're drunk and you had the wherewithal to be able to find, locate the keys for, because nobody does that thing of leaving the keys in the little sun visor. That never happens.
I don't think the Zamboni has a sun visor.
This seems so. They must have either hotwired it or like they like picked the lock or something. I don't even know how you would do that. Like that is, you know,
and there, it's not like Zambonis are just parked everywhere.
No,
maybe they are in Fargo.
That's appointment theft. Yeah. I mean, really, that's like a thing that you not just anybody can do.
And I'm blind.
Yeah.
do we have the Darwin watch? Is it lurking around
yes,
there somewhere?
We do have the Darwin
watch. Should do that here. We'll get that out of the way, and then we'll do our top five for today. Here is your let me just find my open here. Here is your Darwin watch for Thursday, right here on the Rick Emerson Radio Program.
Some bad stuff is about to go down.
Scissors.
Don't. Another one bites the dust.
Don't.
Another one bites the dust. And another one gone. And another one gone. Another one bites the dust.
Hey. Oh, my heart just stopped. There it goes.
Awesome. Here's your Darwin watch for Thursday.
An Australian man has been killed while lopping a palm tree in his garden. The 50-year-old man, whose name has not been released, died when a large foxtail palm came crashing down, striking him in the face in the northern... This is according to the Northern Territory News.
So this is the guy who is below something real heavy. He's, you know, made of flesh.
Yes.
And he's hacking at it with an axe.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, yes. It was believed the man's body lay unnoticed for several hours before he was found and the alarm was raised. Now, this is the interesting part of the story. The freak accident happened at a property in Darwin, Australia.
No way.
Yes.
Well done, Don Taylor. I should note, by the way, we should give a shout out to Don Taylor, who pulled most of these stories herself from the corridor of the hospital. She was finding those on her magical iPhone and then sending them our way.
So, yes, Darwin, Australia is where this took place. Now, according to this, it took police 5 days to release the news of the death, and yesterday they refused to give out any further details. Police Superintendent Daniel Sheen said the accident happened between 2 and 5:15. We're not quite sure when the man died, Superintendent Sheen said. The man had lived at the something residence for some time.
Maybe like an apartment building or like a retirement home or something?
Well, this is what's interesting because it says here it's believed the property owner drove past the accident scene earlier in the day but did not see the man's body. You know, we've discussed this before. A lot of times some of these AP stories are a little short on the facts.
Yes.
So the guy who was killed is not the property owner. And it's not quite sure who he is because the police don't want to release that. But
does it say there if he was blind and drunk?
No, it does not say that.
We have – this is another thing talking about like the guy stealing the Zamboni or whatever. This is another story we get probably, I don't know, every 60 days or so. And it's where somebody is cutting something, trimming something, chainsawing something. And the thing is always way up there and they're always down here. Yeah. And they've got like a real tenuous grasp of gravity and how it operates. And then, you know, and they'll just say, no, hold on, just one, I'm almost done. And they'll do like the one axe stroke too many. And then suddenly it's like you're taking them out in a skull can or something. So just really, this is like when you read those stories about this, you know, like 17 people or something every year that are killed by, like falling coconuts. And you just, you know, you wonder, where are these people and how does this happen? And so apparently in places like Darwin, is it Darwin County or Darwin?
It's just Darwin, Australia. So I would imagine that is a how does it work in Australia? Do they call them states or provinces? Now I feel pretty stupid.
In your face, David Walker.
Yeah.
That's right. Who's the hashtag now, friend? All right, there you go. There's your Darwin watch for Thursday right here in the Rick Emerson radio program.
Don't. Another one bites the dust. Another one bites the dust, and another one gone, and another one gone, another one bites the dust, hey.
By the way, as you know, that David Walker just moments ago was handed today's top five list. These are the top five songs that we'll do here in a moment. The top five songs to which Anna Griffin would brood when she was a morose teenager. And your expression was, it's what I can only call the... on this program, we have come to refer to it as the McRib is back expression, which is a thing. And I think I actually have failed. Oh, here we go. I think I've actually got the soundbite. It's the
McRib is back.
And it's a thing that Jack Osborne did on the first season of The Osbournes. And he was just like goggle-eyed. He was like agog.
Because it's a McRib, of course.
As they were driving by, it was in huge letters. And so now whenever anybody on the show is really surprised by something or when I occasionally make the excited inhalation of air, it becomes this sort of...
McRib is back.
That's... So if you hear somebody say that to you on the show, that's what that means.
I just sang this song last night at karaoke, one of these songs.
Really?
When I announce it, I'll let you know.
Then let's not delay. Ah. Let's find out what these are. Before we actually roll this, so how, first of all, how difficult was it in terms of just remembering or getting an accurate assessment of what songs you brooded to as a teenager?
I spent a lot of time alone in my room as a child, and so it was more the trauma of...
But was it then difficult to sift through the many hundreds of songs that you would do, or did you have a relatively
a few stuck out as
so your hit parade was pretty well defined.
The timing is interesting because my 20th high school reunion was a couple weeks ago and I did not go, but
good,
I'm Facebook friends with enough people that there were a lot of pictures posted, and so it's been a fairly emotionally wrenching last month or so.
Feathered hair?
No, I did not have. I am a lesbian. No,
I will look. Look, we get different style manuals over here on this side of the table.
I'm a baker.
hashtag.
Sorry. Well, this is, I just assumed that everybody goes through that.
Yeah, no. There was a lot of feathered hair when I was, some popped collars. And picture yourself in the late 1980s.
I could just say now, because you've been coming on the show for a few months now, and because you've come on Outlook Portland, and we've talked about this actually off the air, that it's a little bit like boiling the frog, that when people, people sort of come to the show, that, we've learned that we have to, early on, we kind of hold our fire a little bit, because we're the various incarnations of this program, we're just horrible people, and we just say awful things, and if there's someone who comes on, especially someone who seems like a grown-up, and who we respect, we just sort of ease into, we don't start with the Darwin watch usually, or like a penis watch or something. I think we inadvertently did that in your case.
Yes,
I think the first day you were here, we did both of those. So we've learned to sort of modulate it until we understand that, maybe if we learn that people are, or we get a sense of people are not going to take offense at our rather peculiar sense of humor. I could just say this, that when I said feathered hair, there was a little flow chart in my head. There was a little crossroads where I was like, I almost went mullet. See?
Wow.
See? But that's the thing. See, but I, who's to be,
See, I had my mother, up until I think my junior year of high school, at least twice a year would force me to go get my hair permed.
See,
and so I have all these high school pictures of me with my, and I am not, my hair does not do that.
And that's the thing. See, and it's like, it's also difficult because it's like, I have no idea like where the correct comedy was there, because it's like a generational thing. And then there's, like the social and cultural gap. And I'm like, where's the comedy? Where's it going to be? And I went feathered thinking everybody goes that route. I myself, the mullet.
I appreciate that you didn't go mullet. That's you zigged instead of zagged.
That's
I admire
what I'm saying.
That about your comedy.
I think I chose correctly.
You chose wisely. No, all you right. did. You did.
Your hair permed.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to imagine what that would look like. Are we talking
bad,
like the full
bad.
On like the Mrs. Roper
I
perm?
I would refuse to go to school the next day for at least a day, because it was just so hard. And I don't even we don't talk about it now. We don't acknowledge that happened in my family now. But it was just this thing. I mean, I don't know why my mother thought this was important.
Well, see, and this is another thing. It's also, and it's, it's none of my business. I don't know when you were out and when you weren't and whatever. So I didn't know if there was, I didn't know if there were photos of you being put into a poodle skirt or something, by your mom, or you're your mom going and finding, like things that she thought you ought to wear, as opposed to maybe what you were.
It's something we're in, but I'm a cheerleader. That's.
I got to tell you, there's I don't know if they're listening right now, honey. If you're listening, this is a good time to turn down the radio. If different woman, not you. If your friend Anna, same name, different person, is at home. Maybe just distract her with something right now. Wave a bright, shiny object. So we have this couple we know, and they are actually staying at our house today and tomorrow. And they have two kids, a little girl and a little boy, and they're I think 6 and 8. And it's so funny because the dad is very, he's just a full-on screaming Oregon liberal. He's just
Oregon liberals don't scream. They speak very quietly.
He's sort of a hushed tone, sort of a concerned Alan Alda kind of timbre.
The NPR voice.
Exactly.
Yes.
a concerned rumination. But he, he's just a big hippie, and they're they live in not an actual commune, but it's a sort of kind of a communal type neighborhood, and they're members of a bunch of co-ops, and he has, and he constantly wants to tell me how Don Rumsfeld blew up, the World Trade Center or whatever, and it's, and looks through my cupboard and, wants to tell me about, the many healthier and more morally viable alternatives to the products that I'm buying. And he's not a bad guy, but he is very, very liberal in every way, almost to the point of parody. So their son, though, it was just a great kid. The son has apparently always done this. Son, first of all, loves the color pink. Cannot get enough of the color pink. If given the choice of any item, when he's in the store, candy, clothing, wrapping paper, whatever, goes for the hot pink if it's there. The full-on neon disco pink.
Pink used to be a boy's color.
Is that true?
Yes.
See, these are all things I don't know. Is that
long time ago? But yes.
When they had, is that
back when Robin was a man's name? Yeah.
So the kid goes right for that. He also has a strong affinity for playing with dolls, and it's funny to see the dad.
How does he feel about the Village People?
Tana said that I didn't. Rick Emerson didn't make that observation. But it's, you know, but any kind of eschews, you know, sort of what we might call typical boy toys that the dad has bought. And it's so funny to see the immovable object, irresistible force of the dad's, like, progressive mindset and his liberalism at odds with the fact that, like, he so clearly – I'm not saying that he, you know, that he disapproves as such, but I think as an adjunct to these things, he would also like the kid to do some more typically male things. And he will buy the kid toys and try to steer him toward like a different color when they're buying something.
And it's fine as it's not, as long as it's not my child.
And it's like, and it's like, and it's one of those things that I can just sort of comment on, like Howard Cosell, because it's not my kid. Like I have no, it doesn't matter to me, whatever. And I like to think that it wouldn't matter to me if he was, and the kid with that great, like, unguarded ebullience that only children and the very, very old can conjure up. He's like, hey, Tim, why don't we just, look at this color? And she's like, no, I love this color. And the kid will lean down and just, like, pick up, like, a handful of, like, whatever the pink thing is and just, like, hug it. And you see the dad just kind of do that, like, all right. So it's, what was my point here? So I was just going to say that, everybody's, I guess everybody's story is different, whatever path you walk in life, wherever you come from. I didn't know if there was some stage where, like, you know, where like your mom was just like dressing you in like a lot of like sequins and spangles or something.
My mother, there was definitely some sort of trying to guide in certain directions. Yeah. Because I was born this way. There's really absolutely no doubt. I mean, like, you know, as a kid, imagine the fairy tales. Mm-hmm. I was the prince. Like, absolutely no.
Excellent.
Why would you go after the prince when you go after the princess? I mean, let's be serious about this. So, like, I look back now and it's very, very clear that some things are genetic. But no, it was. My mother was wonderful when I came out, but.
But there was a subtle sort of perhaps guiding to...
If I could nudge you in this direction, I will nudge you in this direction.
So it's like when you're giving English to the pinball, you know, a little bit. Like you're not shaking the game.
It's a tilt. That's right. No, you're not tilting it.
But
you will get your hair curled, yeah. That makes you more womanly. I don't understand that, but...
All right. You know, it's funny. Even that slight detour, which like a regular, like a talented talk show host could have done that in like 5 seconds. I think it was about 12 minutes ago. These are the top five songs to which you would brood as a teenager. You would be in your room. Do you have siblings?
Younger brother.
So you had your own bedroom, so you'd be in there, door closed, maybe blinds drawn, staring blankly at a wall and just sort of pondering how no one knows your teenage
Nobody
pain.
Nobody understands.
Excellent.
And what was scary when I was looking at this was how literal. There's really not even any creativity in brooding songs. I mean, these are nobody understands me. I'm different.
You know, it's like I the other day I did the top five songs. I did a sort of variation on this. I did the top five songs to which I would brood after a breakup. And I found that just by definition, most of them were from when I was like late, you know, teenagers to early 20s. Because I don't know, because I think that's when they're really like hardcore emotional. You know, that's when everything, you're just sort of bipolar for a long time. And everything is either the best thing that's ever happened, or it's the darkest day of your life.
And no one has ever felt this before.
Right. And more importantly, like, you have not felt it before. It's a new experience to you, and your brain, you know, and your chemicals are all, like, out of balance in your head, and you're basically insane for a few years, and everything registers as, like, a 10 on the emotion scale. So you have no need for subtlety in any way. That's why kids immediately just gravitate right to like just wearing nothing but black and like staring at a Jim Morrison poster and listening to Disintegration over and over again. Because why not? You know? All right. So we will. Have I actually played the top five theme at all?
No, I have not played
Jesus
that.
Jesus, God. I got to be taken up back and
it's
put down.
It's going to be 6 o'clock and we're still going to be here.
That's the other thing is you realize with this show, there's no one to tell me no. It's the problem with having your name, in the name of the joint. You just. It is actually dark outside. It was light when we started this. Oh, good God.
We miss you, Don.
I think you speak for everyone there. All right, these are the top five songs to which Anna Griffin would brood when she was a teenager. David Walker, what is our number five song?
Number five song is Left of Center by Suzanne Vega.
Suzanne Vega, Left of Center, is our, and this is, so what era would this have been?
This is on the Pretty in Pink soundtrack.
Left of So we're talking, what, like maybe 86, 87?
Yeah.
So you were probably in junior high, right?
Yeah, and if a song appears in a John Hughes movie, and it's one of your brooding songs, I mean, that you are instantly a complete poser, right?
I don't know that that's true. I mean, I think John Hughes films ring true because they are maybe not universally relatable, but relatable. I think they're relatable to a large degree. I think everybody. I'll put it this way: everybody has some part of a John Hughes film to which they can relate, and every John Hughes film has some section that everybody can agree on. Maybe not the whole film, but it is that thing where, you know, every Hughes film has something to say for it. It's tempting to write him off as being cliched or sentimental, but, you know, some things seem like cliches, but that's just because they're true. And I think he really did nail a certain sort of kind of zeitgeist.
Yes, and I'm just happy that Molly Ringwald isn't dead. Because she's one of those who could have, like, you could have seen her descend into some bad things.
Like a Lindsay Lohan sort of an outcome for her?
These, of course, were pre-internet days, so that makes a difference.
I actually did not know much about Suzanne Vega until actually I met my wife, and she's a huge Suzanne Vega fan, and I think I basically just knew the Tom's Diner thing, and the Luca, you know, and so I had just like this thumbnail knowledge, and that was one of the, and you just that thing when you're first dating where it's like you just sort of, you know, like what's in your record collection, what's in my record collection, and she and I have very, very different music tastes, and this is one of the things that she said that she was going to like teach me. She's like, I'm going to teach you to appreciate Suzanne Vega. Which was successful, by the way. It's one of those things that I am really glad that I was introduced to. What is it about this song that?
If you listen to the lyrics, it is truly. It's like nobody understands me. That's basically what this song is about. And her voice also. There's especially on a day like today, a rainy, dark day like today. There's just something very haunting, is a cliche, but there's a certain tone to her voice.
Sort of an ethereal ethereal kind of poignancy.
It just reminds me of middle school.
The thing about Suzanne Vega, too, is that she writes such great, it's almost sense to try to call them catchy, but they're really accessible, enjoyable pieces of pop. I mean, they're very crafted and polished, but at the same time, it's like Elvis Costello, they're really smart. They're really, you know, and her wordplay is really great, too. She has really, her verbal dexterity is enviable.
Yeah.
And she's avoided being hemmed into anyone's sound is the other thing. Like, you kind of always know a Suzanne Vega song. But, I mean, you know, like, she did the Luca thing, and then, you know, she did, I remember when I heard Blood Makes Noise, which is this weird sort of, like, grinding, almost like industrial kind of a song. It reminds me a lot of Amy Mann.
There's an album of Disney covers that if anybody out there who has children or is still a child, and she does a cover of Stay Awake, which is just, I mean, it was on the lullaby list for all my kids. Just the perfect voice for that kind of thing. To put small children to sleep, I guess. It's not really a compliment.
Is that the criteria for whether something's good if it makes your child go to sleep? I mean, not that I'm disapproving. I don't care.
Small children? Oh, yes.
Yeah. Once again.
Ativan, whatever it takes.
These are the top five songs to which Anna Griffin would brood as a teenager. David Walker, what might number four be?
Number four, Dream Operator, Talking Heads.
Now, I have very, very limited knowledge of Talking Heads, like almost none. So you'll have to educate me a little bit about this song. What is it about and why? How did it speak to
you? Oh, my God, I have no clue, but it's cool.
Is it just one of the...
And when I was 15 years old?
Is it just the vibe that David Byrne gave off that you felt that he saw into your soul?
It's all about none of this is real. You're going to, you know, it's... I mean, what's cool about the Talking Heads is it's also... everything they did was both smart and kind of weird, mm-hmm. in a way that if you were a teenager, you felt smart while being weird.
Right.
And David Byrne is just awesome, even now.
He's one of those guys. David Byrne is not unlike, like John Waters or like, I don't know, or even like, you know, Captain Beefheart or one of those guys who's just like from day one was just like on some other plane. That you can see from this one, but like I can't get there.
I would like your drugs, whatever they are. I would take them.
Yeah, he just—it's like he's on some other plateau of existence, and he just sends missives every now and again.
Asking what a Talking Heads song is about is a little bit like asking what a David Lynch movie is about.
Yeah, see,
like,
so.
I got no freaking clue, but I know I enjoyed it.
I'm with you.
You wish you were me. I wish I was you.
It's a great song.
Yeah, it's a great song.
I've never heard this.
Oh, it's I think this is from True Stories, which is just a great album.
And names tell your story.
Wow.
This song is your dream. You're the dream of the ringer.
Wow.
And this is, it's funny, because this album, well, just, you know how certain albums have, like, just a very visceral time period in your life?
A talismanic
effect. And this album, and in particular this song, I got at about the time when many of the people I had been friends with in middle school were starting to discover sex, and even more than sex, starting to discover drugs. And I just was, I was an athlete. You know, I mean, I was a geek then, and I'm a geek now. And I was an athlete and a very good student, and just didn't do that stuff
right
at that point. And so it's just, there's just something, it's a very visceral loneliness that I remember from that period of time that this song evokes.
Well, and it's really tempting. I was talking to Don about this the other day, that I think almost as a reflexive, I don't know, it's like maybe some sort of survival instinct or whatever. When you get to a certain age, it's tempting to diminish or to make fun of that, those feelings, or that time in your life, or the stuff you listened to then, or the whatever you went through. But I mean, being, you know, as the guy says, as Christian Slater said in Pump Up the Volume, sometimes being young is less fun than being dead. You know, there's a time where you just sit there and it's like, and you, because you just don't. It's not that kids. I mean, kids are so much smarter than anybody ever gives them credit for. So it's nothing to do with intelligence. It's just that having spent your entire life, you know, in that house and not being out on your own or in the world, you just can't conceive of the rest of the world. Or that your life might, where your life is going to take you, or, you know, how much better or different the rest of your life is going to be from where it is. All you can see is that moment, because that's as far as the road has taken you so far.
And there's not a lot of frames of reference to draw from when
right.
you're that age.
And I think what you forget, and you get, it's funny, because, I mean, I talk about my high school reunion, and seeing these people on Facebook now, what I realize, I mean, this is going to sound very after school special, but is it, I mean, we're just, especially now approaching 40, we're all pretty much the same. We have the same basic
right.
worries and stresses. And back then, I think everybody at that age is just sort of driven by something primal, whether it's you're constantly horny or you're desperately afraid of being laughed at
right.
or you're going to go to Harvard or whatever. That, I mean, you're all basically operating from a place of fear, but you're so wrapped up in your own fear, you don't recognize that. But it's all going to be okay, kids.
It is. But as you said, the idea that, you know, the idea that it's one of those things that could sound silly, but it's not. It's not silly then, certainly. The idea that David Byrne or the song or the whatever, that there's some, like, ethereal something out there somewhere that kind of gets what you are. You know, and I've talked, to say extensively is, I think, an understatement, but I've talked extensively about music and, you know, my adolescent experience and discovering music. And, you know, it's that whole thing where, you know, when you're, I think for a lot of teenagers, you just feel so like such a freak. You just feel like such a misfit and an outcast. And it's like, it was so liberating to me when I discovered rock and roll. Because, you know, there was just not much of that in my family, but it's, you know, and I had a friend of mine who sort of, you know, slipped me like the right cassette tape at the right time or whatever. But it was this two things. One was that there were all of these artists I discovered who were not only sort of freaks themselves, but they made it seem like they made it seem really cool, you know. And, you know, whether it's something as theatrical and as predictable as like listening to Kiss or Alice Cooper, or whether, you know, when you hear like a Beatles song or a Stone song and you go like, well, this is like nothing I have ever heard. This is really weird and bizarre and great. And clearly these guys aren't like everybody else. And I guess that's OK. And again, you say that and just it sounds so much like a sort of, you know, what did we learn here today? But it's like, but there is a point in your life where like you do realize that for the first time. And stuff that seems obvious or that you take for granted as knowledge about yourself later in life, there was a point when you didn't have it. And the moment when you get that is sort of a great, you know. And the other thing that music did for me, and I suspect for you guys, and David, you've talked about this a lot, is that when I heard, I was a huge, huge, huge Led Zeppelin fan when I was a teenager. I mean, just I was. It was almost a fetish for me, but it was because it sounded so removed from anything I'd ever heard. And I compared hearing Led Zeppelin records for the first time as living my whole life in this small, confined, sort of darkened room. And then all of these lights went on, and I realized that it wasn't a small room. It was actually this enormous sort of palace, but I never knew that because the lights had never been on. And it was suddenly that I saw, like, I don't have to spend my whole life in this stupid town of 18,000 people, you know? I don't have to be the guy that grows up and hates his life and then dies two miles from where he's born. You know, and that is a liberating thing, and music really gives you the ability to see what would be invisible and hidden otherwise.
That was almost like a segue into number three. That was really nicely done.
Excellent. And by the way, well done keeping us on track just there. I saw what you did just there. These are Anna Griffin's top five songs to which she would brood as a teen. David Walker, word number three. What is that song?
Number three, Dear Prudence, The Beatles.
Oh, I'm sorry. I had these up in the wrong order. I'm sorry. That's it's my fault. Okay, everybody just...
The dominoes have fallen.
It was such a huge buildup, and then I just failed. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
That's totally my fault. Okay,
we can
we're
going to...
No. We're going to have this right here. I had something queued up, and it was wrong, and then I... You know what was? That was hubris for thinking too well of myself or having these segues down flawlessly here. All right. Okay. When is the first time you heard the Beatles? Was it this, or was it something else?
Oh, I'm sure it was something... I'm sure it was, like, the Beatles doing Twist and Shout or something like that earlier. But my mom and my stepfather were not quality music buffs.
Yes.
I have a real childhood affinity for ABBA, thanks to my mother, and a bit of a Neil Diamond fetish. But
that's okay. I have a lot of Conway Twitty in my head because of my dad.
Speaking of curls, yeah.
Yes. Look, Trump, let me tell you this: you were speaking to someone whose parents I actually, my brother and I were conscripted into service in my parents'... we didn't call it country then, we called it country western. My parents' country western band. So there are a lot of photos of myself and my brother on stage performing in a country music family band.
What was your role?
I played a really, really bad guitar. My brother was quite a talented drummer, but I was not a talented guitar player. I was a miserable guitar player. But it was less about quality and more about togetherness.
It's like
by
the Partridge
force.
Family, but with bolero ties?
Yes, and with no talent, and with more shame. So, yeah, no, I know what you're talking about with your parents and their music taste being different from your own.
I have a question for you. The older you get, do you find that Beatles songs, especially more than anything you listen to in your youth, takes on a whole new meaning?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I get the drug references now in a way that I didn't as a child. But
the thing, and I won't say it took me a long time to appreciate the Beatles, but I, to your point, for most of my life, I have gravitated more to the pop side of the Beatles. I am very much a Twist and Shout, I want to hold your hand, she loves you, mm-hmm. You know, yeah, yeah, yeah. And it was the sort of the weird, arty, ethereal stuff later on that I just didn't resonate with me. It was too, you know, I think it was just, I was too much in my, like, kind of Ramones mode for mm-hmm. a long time. But as I've gotten older, it's that thing that I guess everybody does, where you hear the Beatles, you know, sort of one day and you go like, my God, and it just sort of hits you again how layered and textured they are and how the songs have so much more depth and meaning to them, often hidden or obscured or or implied, and you just don't notice that, you know, the first 1,000 times you hear it, and those songs do hold up to the 1,001 listens because there's always something different there.
Yeah, I've been on a listen to a lot of Beatles lately, and every time it seems like I'm hearing a song for the first time, as I, you know, I'm looking at 40 through the rearview mirror at this point. So,
well, you just pick things up. I mean, they're just crazy, crazy genius, talented.
I have a friend of mine who says something about the Beatles, about John Lennon specifically. How much of an impact he's made on the culture, but also on individual listeners, where you're there and like the Beatles are sort of performing for you. She said that she doesn't remember the Beatles, but she misses them because because on the one hand, it's like you're presented this beautiful, amazing, golden thing, and then at the same time, depending on how old you are, presented with like the knowledge that, and it's gone, you know?
Yeah.
And so you get the beauty, and then you also immediately get the bittersweet of like, and it's gone, you know, it's not around anymore. You know, but it's just such astounding. Music. There's that story about the Soviet Union was convinced that the Beatles were actually that they were the Beatles had been created by the government to influence children, induce moral decay in the youth. And their evidence for that was that the Beatles music was so advanced and complicated and brilliant that it could not possibly have been written by these four guys from this working class town. And you listen to some of this, you kind of get what they were talking about there. Hmm. These are the top five songs to which Anna Griffin would brood as a teenager. Where are we at, David Walker?
Number two, In Suburbia, Pet Shop Boys.
Fantastic. Pet Shop Boys for the win.
I grew up in the suburbs outside New York and just thought this song was so smart. Just got it exactly right. I was obnoxious as a teenager.
It's like they lifted the lid off the sordid Levitt town, the stifling uniformity-filled Peyton Place of your youth.
Suburban Connecticut, yes.
That's right. The mean streets.
The gritty streets of Stamford.
Really? That's where I grew up, too, actually. That's
really?
Yeah. It's tough there. It's tough there. And Bridgeport's right down the street, so...
David Walker actually was made to dress in a poodle skirt every now and again, just so you know. The photos I could show you.
And the perm. Every now and then the perm.
Yes.
To round it out, by the way, I did have the mullet and a full-on power mullet. It was aggressive.
It could hurt you if you weren't careful.
Was this in the country western band?
No. This is later when I was cool, Anna. After I discovered Zeppelin, and it's like I didn't really... It's a long story, but it's like that whole thing of like somehow I thought that like having, you know, long in the back, short in the front. Somehow I thought that like that would give me the best of both worlds. I'd be rocking, but then also like I could pass as respectable, like for my job at Orange Julius. That did not happen, by the way.
I was one of those kids, one of those girls who did not want to be seen by anyone, and so the bangs would grow and grow and grow and grow.
Dress for invisibility.
Exactly, the cousin it look. Yeah, it was very. I was also, 6 feet tall, so it was a little hard not to.
Hard for you to blend in. Yeah. I had the idea that I was going to look cool, but yet no tools with which to do that, and no knowledge or ability to make it possible. So there are these hilarious photos of me where I've just got, like, you know, really long mullet, really short front hair, and then in every single photo I seem to be wearing this blue and white tie-dyed Led Zeppelin shirt because I purchased two of them, so then I could be wearing one every day. And for about 6 months... That's the only shirt that I would wear. Wash one, wear the other for 6 months. And the thing is, no one else knew that I had two.
You were filthy.
Yeah, they're like, look at the grubby poor kid who only has one shirt. Ooh, and that mullet. That's no picnic either.
Oh, no, the rule... Part of the reason I think that we pair off with other people, human nature, is just to protect ourselves from our own worst instincts. And my partner, we have a rule in my house. When my hair begins to approach... mullet conditions, that's when I must go get
there's
a cut.
Klaxon.
She tells me,
sounds.
I know. She says that you're getting close to it's shaggy is cute, mullet is unacceptable. Go get your hair cut.
Fair enough. You know, that's a core. That's a core need that is being met.
That is
really.
Love right there is what that is.
The person who will tell you that your hair needs to be, you know, something needs to be tended to right now. Ugh.
You may listen to the Indigo Girls. You may not look like one of the Indigo Girls. That's the rule.
It's like to this day, if I'm writing any sort of like an email at home or a letter, if it's like a business letter or something where I want to come off as smart, I will actually, I made Lara early on swear. I'm like, sometimes I'm going to have you read letters before I send them. And you have to tell me if I come off like a dick or just a jackass in any way. You know, I don't care how much you think it's going to hurt my feelings. You have to tell me if I'm about to do something publicly that's just going to look like, douchey, because it's just like, I can't, I don't want to be that guy. And, and it's like trusting that the person will not let you leave the house, literally or figuratively, looking like a tool. If you can trust somebody, it's like Trent Reznor said, love is knowing that the person next to you could knife you in your sleep, but probably won't. Everything seems to take a dark turn today. I don't know why that is. The This is another band, by the way, that I had almost no knowledge of until I met my wife, and then she's very into, like, the Thompson Twins, Pet Shop Boys, Erasure kind of a thing. And
God, the Thompson Twins. I'm about to start twitching.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Just a couple years ago, in fact, when I went to London, one of the things we did in London, we went to Brixton. Is that a place? I think it might
sure.
be Brixton.
Yeah,
sure. We went to that or a place like that to see Erasure because I had no experience. And it was like one of those. It was weird because I had taken her to all these like rock shows where everybody knew every word, you know, but her. And she's sort of the girl in the back, like, doesn't know the lyrics to Hell's Bells or something. And then I was in this, like, Erasure show where everybody knew every single... It was really awesome, actually, to be able to see it from the other side.
Do British people still make music, or is it just Americans who go over there, pick up the accent, and come back?
I think that... I think there may have been some sort of embargo passed. I think after Oasis, there was some sort of a resolution. Because British people, what always happens is...
We will give you Madonna if you stop.
That's the thing, is I think they just realized it was like it was a point of diminishing returns, because they would just spend all this time growing artists, like, in a greenhouse somewhere. And then they would say, like, okay, Noel Gallagher, you are ready to take on the world. And then, like, Oasis would come over here, and they would just stand at the airport for 3 or 4 hours, because nobody knew who they were, and so the ride would never arrive. You know, and then they would end up playing a show in some guy's living room, and then they would go back home. And they tried that again with Robbie Williams a couple years. Britain has this thing where they think that they can just go like, and now everyone, America, you will listen to this and love it. And it's like, and we just go, no, we're not gonna, you know. And then we just go back to listening to John Mayer or something. So, you know, not like we're any prize. All right, these are the top five songs to which Anna Griffin from the Oregonian would brood when she was a teenager, full of.
Rage and...
Did you sit around and write the obligatory Plath-esque poetry in your room?
You know, I actually miss the poetry phase, thankfully. I think I went straight on into, you know, soft porn, really.
Wow. Okay. If you'd asked me to fill in that sentence there, Mad Lib style, I don't think I would have come up with that. But I'm giving it a hearty thumbs up. I think I can speak for David on that front as well. David Walker, what is number one?
Number one song I was just singing last night at karaoke, Heaven Can Wait.
Well done.
Meatloaf.
I have to tell you, I did not expect this to be on the list. I would never have picked this.
It's a twist. Well, my senior year in high school, I took a lover, as the kids say these days.
a caller.
My first real boyfriend, and we see how that turned out. And he was from the wrong side of the tracks, and this was his makeout song.
Really?
Oh yeah.
So
yeah.
All right. Here's the thing. You just have to know this is. I have to know more. There's just no getting around it. All right. So when he was from the wrong, side of the tracks. Now because we know each other, but maybe not that well. You know. I'm sure we'll get to the point where I just know your life like my own, like the back of my hand. Which side of the tracks were you on?
I was the upper middle class white girl from the right side of the tracks.
All right, and he was the scruffy but lovable, charmingly roguish.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know.
At the time, yeah, sure, yeah.
In retrospect, in hindsight, he just didn't shower much.
Yeah.
Just worked at an auto parts store, and that was enough.
There's a fine line between wrong side of the tracks and white trash.
Yes.
Esther. And you at 17 your vision is not quite so clear.
Yeah, well, it all sort of blends together.
It does.
My family straddled that line from most of the time I lived at home. My mother would occasionally, my mother would try to introduce culture, and then you go in the garage, and there would be pallets of empty bottles of that generic beer, where it was the white label and it just said beer. Yeah, so my dad, they were balancing agents for one another.
It sounds less sort of dastardly when I talk about skipping AP calculus to go make out. But that's
wow. I'm never gonna make the Mathlete finals if I don't go to class. So this was his makeout song. So did you just sort of suss that out because it would always sort of seem to pop up in the cassette deck? Or did he tell you?
He played this album constantly.
Baby, hold on. We got to stop for a second. I got to find my battle to hell. Hold on. Don't you move. You stay right there. Chad's going to find his makeout record du jour.
And it's one of those, in retrospect, I'm not sure if this was his makeout song or if it's just that he played this album constantly
and
we were making out constantly. Yeah. Yeah, that it may be that
the overlap was inevitable.
If you've never done it before, it's that we've talked about, that feeling that no one's ever done this before.
Oh yeah,
And this album is a, this is the sort of quintessential I'm a horny teenage boy album.
I'm so glad you said that.
Is, Paradise by the Dashboard Light. Oh,
yeah,
yes.
All revved up, no place to go.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. This is the album. I'm not lying. This is a CD in my car right now. I've been listening to it for weeks nonstop.
Well, it's one of those, you talk about picking up more of the Beatles, looking at the Beatles differently, and now it's like you listen to Meatloaf, and it's just, I mean, it's just so kitschy and fantastic and hilarious.
I can tell you are among your people, because I love Meatloaf. I love Meatloaf. Sarah Dillon loves Meatloaf. For her birthday, I think this past year, Greg Nibbler actually contrived to have Meatloaf call their show. He was able to hook up a Meatloaf call in, and she didn't know. And he sort of sprung. He's like, "Let's go to the unemployment phone and see who it is," or whatever, on the Fun Employment Radio. He did the phone, and it was Meatloaf, like, there. And she, you know, it's like she can, you know, she is so close to a happy death at this point. She doesn't really need to do anything else.
I sang this song to Sarah about 6 months ago. Just ran into her at a bar. It was karaoke night, and I was like, "Sarah, I know you love Meatloaf. This is for you." And she,
you know, and the thing is, it's Meatloaf, but, you know, we've done many, many top fives on the show related to Jim Steinman, who's the guy who really, you know, he really is the Geppetto, you know, behind all of this. I mean, you know, and you want to talk about, they were just these sort of, like, Wagnerian, like, you know, Brian Wilson talked about those Teenage Symphonies to God, but it's, like, more almost, it's a bold statement, I almost don't want to say it, but almost more than any act I can think of, almost more than any other band, any other performer, Steinman took everything you feel when you were a teenager. Again, angry, horny, confused, whatever. Blew it up to like 1,000 times larger than life size. And then just distilled it down into this extract of about 77 minutes on this record. And it's like, and you realize that like he either at that time knew or felt or at least remembered exactly not how teenage years actually are, because that's not important. It's what they feel like when you're there. And that's a neat trick, you know?
It's like Ghost World. It's like Dan Clough's Ghost World. This is, and part of the reason I've been listening to this so much is because I just had a birthday, and I'm getting older, and I want to reminisce what it was like to be 18 years old again.
Before the light in your eyes dimmed.
Yeah, yeah. Let me go
along. Ghost World is, I mean, it's... Freaks and Geeks was that way too, where it was like every, you know, that was a mix of like how it felt and how it really was, which was made it so horrifying to watch. Another song that falls into this category for me is, you know, and he sang it when he was 24, I think 23, when I was a huge Alice Cooper fan, and hearing him sing 18. Yeah. And there's that whole thing about the, you know, where he talks about being a, you know, I'm a boy and I'm a man and, you know, confused. And at the end, and he says, you know, that I'm a boy and I'm a man, I'm 18 and I like it. And it's that whole, like, you know, that sense of like, because when you're, you know, when you're young, it's like you're, it, as much as it sucks in some ways, it's like your whole body is powered by this plutonium generator, and you just have this like insane, like cracked out energy, like in every cell of your body,
and all of the nerve endings are turned up all the way,
all the time. Yeah, and Steinman really just was able to, you know, take that essence and just put it in vinyl, which is not easy.
I mean, I want to say, as someone now who has children, who is looking toward their teenage years, I mean, it's utterly terrifying.
I can't even imagine. I mean, I don't have kids for lots of reasons. I mean, I would be a poor parent, chief among them. But, you know, and in some ways I know that I will miss out on certain things, but I think I will be spared certain things. And it's like the, when your teenager goes out on a date or on a whatever, and you immediately insert yourself into like, what was I doing at whatever age, you know?
Oh God, yeah. I don't have kids, but I've got I have two goddaughters. One's 19, the other's getting ready to turn 16, and I've had to have the talk with both of them because their parents were sort of remiss in that.
Right.
And
was that awkward?
Oh yeah. So are you having intercourse with your boyfriend?
I can't even. It just gives me the hives even to think about. I can't even.
Well, especially because, you know, I don't have kids by choice, and so it's like, I'm having this, and I'm remembering what it was like to be 15 or 16 and not thinking there's anything wrong with like trying to cop a feel.
Oh,
but now it's like thinking
all this stuff is normal.
It's totally normal,
totally normal
until it's like your child or somebody. Yeah.
Then well, you're just like, I'm going to buy a shotgun as soon as I leave here.
Yeah.
That's the thing, actually. And I will say this to you. By not having kids, the one thing I will be spared is having to mouth all of the ridiculous hypocrisies, you know, of like, of course it's wrong to have sex, insert, or, you know, drink, do drugs, whatever it is you did. Anything, you know, because that's how you can always tell what parents did. It's the stuff they are most vociferous about, you know, in terms of keeping their kids from doing it. You know, and so I don't, you know, I can just, you know.
No, don't stay up till 3 o'clock in the morning playing Lode Runner.
Lode Runner. Wow. Well done.
I can design my own level.
Nerd. like I wasn't at home doing the same thing with Impossible Mission. Another visitor. Stay a while. Stay forever. I love this song. I'm so glad you put this on those. This has just ended the whole... It's been a challenging couple of days here. And then I imprisoned you two in the studio and kept you here for like 5 hours. Talking about my...
Is it Friday yet?
Ridiculous nonsense. You've got a family and you've got the projects you're working on. You've both got, you know, people you should be living life. And instead you're here in like Rick Emerson's pit of sadness. Sadness and stammering. So, in any event, but that Meatloaf, man, that's as good as it gets right there. That really is just... That is some of the best music.
I'm so glad I was a little, because I told Cheryl I was a little embarrassed to acknowledge, but no, every time I come on here, I just feel more and more at home here in the pit of sadness.
Seriously, no. This is you are at home here. I have long ago dispatched with the idea that they were like guilty pleasures, you know. I forget who somebody was. It you that made the thing about said the thing about guilty pleasures?
Yes, it was me. The only thing you should feel guilty about getting pleasure from is like child pornography.
Yeah. You're selling crack to school children. Yeah. That's a guilty pleasure. This is just like stuff you enjoy. So it's like, you know.
It's nice to see the line defined. Thank you.
In case there was a quiz on that later.
I was wondering, the crack to the children on the playground? Oh, okay.
I went through a lot of my high school years pretending, as dumb as it's not that I did not like Bon Jovi, listening to it at home because I thought my metal friends would disown me. You know, that I wasn't listening to Metallica. I was at home listening to like the Slippery When Wet record. My friends, they wouldn't think I was like hard. You know, they wouldn't like I wasn't a tough guy because you'd make that mistake. You'd think I was a tough guy otherwise. And so I got to the point where I was like, F it, you know? It is whatever speaks to you. So
you were living
Meatloaf.
On a prayer. Excellent.
Thank you. That was a fantastic tough fight. It's one of the best we've had in a long
you.
Time.
Thanks
well
very
done.
Much. Thanks.
So we'll wrap this up here. And I just want to say thank you to David Walker for coming in.
Oh, no problem. Thank you very much for having me.
It was really, really, it was great to have you on. And the door is always open, as we say. And especially, you know, today we're just sort of kind of playing through it today. Tomorrow. Tomorrow we'll be here as well. Our friend Big Jim Willow will be in the studio. And then Monday, I'm actually going to be gone. I should say a little bit of business here. I'm going to be gone on Monday. I will be traveling back from Glorious Provo. I will be returning too late to do the show. Depending on who is here Monday, I may in fact try to Skype in from the airport security in Salt Lake because they do have the body scanning thing there. So I might, you know, like maybe be able to hear like the groping.
If you make it to Provo, given your dress plans.
That's true, I guess. Well, you know, and that's the other thing is like I can't make too much trouble in the Provo airport or they'll keep me, you know. And it's like, you know, stopping from going there is one thing. Being stuck there and can't get back to Portland is a whole different kettle of fish.
They're looking for as many white people as they can recruit to Utah.
Yes, right. You know? It's running low.
We have a short sleeve collared shirt and a Book of Mormon for you. Here.
Thank you.
Welcome.
So that's Monday. We'll be doing a what I might call a best of. It's just some old crap. That's going to be played on Monday. Tomorrow we'll be here. So Anna Griffin, reader and print in the Oregonian, online at OregonLive.com. David Walker, you can hear him. Court and Fatboy, Cascadia.fm, Wednesdays at 10 a.m.
Tuesdays.
Damn.
That's right.
All right. Courtney, you don't open for Courtney. She opens for you.
She opens for me. That's
all right.
Right.
Okay. That is Tuesdays, 10 a.m. at Cascadia.fm. You can also read his writings online at Badass with Z's, Badass Mofo. .com. The Rick Emerson Show, of course, today brought to you by a series of fine business partners, including Squires Electric. Find out more about them at squireselectric.com or 503-252-1609. 503-252-1609. No job too small or too large. Any kind of wiring, Ethernet wiring, electrical wiring, whatever, your home or business. But as to do with wiring in your home or office, they can make your life easier. Squires Electric or 503-252-1609. We'll talk a bit more about those guys tomorrow. For today, we want to say thank you for listening. And you can find out more about Dawn Taylor and what is going on with her husband Patrick by checking out her Facebook page for updates and so forth. We come to you live from the studios of the Emerson News Network. As always, we thank you for listening. Our chief of staff is Cheryl Kanako, executive producer Bruce Agler, advanced science and technology brought to you by Mr. Thomas Gill. And at the news desk, it is David Walker in for Dawn Taylor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you all tomorrow. Be safe. Bye now.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
Money, baby. We'll make a lot of ease of money, baby. Come on now.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.